House Subcommittee on Health Policy, and I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2800. I'd like to have the sponsors of the bill come up, and then I will close the public hearing on 2800 and move to a work session on 2650, and then we'll come back to the testimony on the other testimony on 2800. So, Sandy, would you like to tell us about House Bill 2800, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee. House Bill 2800 is brought to you at the request of chief sponsors Representative Barnhart and Butler and Senator Avakian. The bill is authorizing the State Board of Psychologists Examiners to grant prescriptive authority to certain licensed psychologists. It also requires the board to adopt the standards for the psychologist seeking the prescriptive authority and to develop and identify limited drugs that may be prescribed. It authorizes the board to charge a fee for issuing the certificate of this prescriptive authority. This bill does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you, Sandy. And with us today, we have the chief co-sponsors, Representative Barnhart, Representative Butler, and the floor is yours, gentlemen. Just identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Phil Barnhart. I'm a state representative from House District 11, encompassing a piece of Eugene and Central Lane and Linn counties. And I appreciate the opportunity to come and testify today on this bill. This bill has been a long time in development, and it's gone through a number of versions. I believe the bill was first introduced 6 years ago, and it has had a number of iterations. I think the important thing for the committee to be aware of when it deals with a bill that deals with scope of practice is to understand that the scope of practice issues essentially have to do with whether or not a professional is qualified by education, training, and experience to do the work that the law proposes that that person be allowed to do. This bill establishes a subset of psychologists who are especially qualified and trained and have an appropriate a practicum experience with supervision in order to do the work that the bill proposes that they be allowed to do. Psychologists are by training experts in diagnosis of mental disorders. Psychology developed as an academic a pursuit about 150 years ago and progressed through time as an academic pursuit. It became a profession around the end of World War I and actually became a licensed profession with the understanding that psychologists were going to practice clinically essentially after World War II, during which time, during the war, psychologists were used to help place troops in various categories for training because of the skill in diagnostics. What this bill does is essentially allows a few psychologists who take specialized training in psychotropic medication and the administration of psychotropic medications to use their diagnostic skill in that area to include treatment not only with psychotherapy and counseling, but also with medications where it's appropriate. You'll hear a lot about the bill's limitations and the way in which it is limited so that psychologists are careful to work only within the areas of their expertise and not outside of those areas. We think the bill has been carefully drafted to make certain that that happens. I've discovered, other people have discovered and pointed out to me that there are a couple of errors in the bill. It will require amendment before it's ready to work. There's one minor error on the top of page 2 where definition is changed a little bit. And there's another error, which I think others will discuss, involving the kinds of drugs, schedule of drugs, which psychologists can prescribe. As you know, this bill came out during the big crush, and there were some errors in it. But I think I'll stop there and answer any questions the committee may have.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart, and thank you for bringing the bill forward. And Representative Butler, questions?
Yes, I do have a couple.
Okay. Representative Greenman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for being here today. I have a couple of questions, if I may. But the first one is, there's been some criticism about the specific requirements for education. If would you be open to modification of those education requirements if we could reach some compromise to get opponents moving at least to the neutral range if there were some changes in that area?
Chair Kotek, Representative Greenlick, I would be open to changes in the bill that maintained its essential shape. What I would say about the education requirements today is that these, as I understand it, and other people who will be testifying later actually understand this part of the bill better than I do, but as I understand it, these are the requirements that have been essentially in use by the military when it has established prescribing psychologists over the period of 15 or 20 years. And the program required by the American Psychological Association as it looked at this issue to establish the program that's actually in use. If the committee believes that some additional educational work is needed, I think if it's reasonable that it would be appropriate and sensible to do, it would be fine.
May I ask another question? Yes. Follow up, please. Have you had a chance to look at the educational requirements for other non-physicians who prescribe psychotropic drugs, specifically mental health nurse practitioners, and I think now clinical nurse specialists who specialize in psychiatric care. Have you had a sense of how their educational criteria relate to the educational criteria proposed in the bill?
Chair Kotek, Representative Greenlick, I have not made a specific study of that. I think that's an excellent question to ask those who have more knowledge of the specific educational requirements than I do.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Chair Kotek. I'm State Representative Tom Butler from House District 60. And unless you think that I'm here just to harass the committee, I want to remind you that House District 60 is the largest district in the state of Oregon, representing over a quarter of the landmass of the state of Oregon. I frequently say I represent a quarter of the state. It takes 59 other representatives to take care of the other three quarters of the state.
Thank you for taking on that same duty.
Thank you, Chair Kotek. That said, I did represent a district which represented over a third of the landmass of the state when I started in this process, and I became acutely aware that nowhere in House District 60 at that time did we have a single psychiatrist. We did have two psychiatric nurse practitioners, as Representative Greenlink had referred to other folks that could come in and provide some assistance. Those two nurse practitioners were from the state of Idaho, and so when we needed that help through many of those large rural counties, the largest three counties in the state of Oregon, we had to go outside of the state, and then we had to use the prescriptive authority that those nurses worked under to go to psychiatrists in the state of Idaho. Now, there are I understand that there actually is one practicing psychiatrist, I believe, in my district at this particular point. And at one point, I did have a psychiatrist, or not a psychiatrist, someone who practiced this kind of medicine in Ontario, but he's long since retired and is still a valued member of my community. That said, I want to absolutely go on public record how pleased I am to be able to join with Representative Barnard in this presentation of this particular issue, because it is an issue which very much affects rural Oregon, and it isn't just rural House District 60. There are parts of the Oregon coast and parts of North Coast and Central Oregon that this also affects, and as well as along the Columbia Gorge counties, where we do not have the kind of access to all of those professionals that we really would need. Now, there are a couple of states, and Representative Barnard did refer to the fact that U.S. military, the psychologists that work for the U.S. military with the training and the pharmacology, particularly with regard to the psychotropic medicines, have the ability to go ahead and do this. Those folks, some of those will be coming out following the engagement and the completion of the issues overseas, they'll be wanting to return home, and they won't be able to return to Oregon and be able to apply their talents the same way that they have while they've been in the military. But I understand that also Louisiana and New Mexico are other states which provide this opportunity for those folks who have been trained. It has been it has been very successful in those states, so far as I know, and it would give us an opportunity to use at a higher and better usage our School of Pharmacology in the state of Oregon to allow these folks to have this opportunity to go ahead and train in these regards, and then have the ability to do the outreach to assist the rest of the psychiatric community in the utilization and proper implementation of psychotropic drugs. So again, I wanted to just express my gratitude for the long-term relationship that I've been able to establish with Dr. Barnard and what he's done, and I'm just very honored to continue to participate. Again, he actually did represent much of Eastern Oregon for a short period of time during redistricting, and I think he saw the needs that we have and the outreach that's important. And I think that gave us a bond there that we will always be able to enjoy. Thank you very much.
Did he ever get there?
Oh, Madam Chair, Representative Greenlake, he is famous in the Paisley Mosquito Festival, and I think they invite him back every year to the Mosquito Festival, and they want him back in the float.
Thank you, Representative Butler, and thank you for the bipartisan sponsorship of the bill. I really do get the rural health issue. Questions for the representative? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Barnhart and Representative Butler. Representative Butler, you said at one point there was no psychiatrist in your district. Is there now, to your knowledge?
Representative Chair Kotek, Representative Bonamici, I think that I think that a psychiatrist lives, may actually live in Baker County. I think they practice out of Union County, but I'm not sure where they live. But that's available in Union County, which is distance from Baker City to LeGrand, which is about 50 miles. So, but right now it's 50 miles to Boise to Ontario. So we do have psychiatrists in Boise, and I'm told that one of those psychiatrists actually will be available part of one day a week on a regular basis when we have severe cases that our mental health clinics are working in Eastern Oregon.
Thank you. Representative Flores.
Thank you, Chair. As a follow-up, Representative Butler, then, in regard to psychiatrists, and very limited, maybe one, what about psychologists, since that happens to be the focus of this particular bill?
Chair Kotek, Representative Flores, and that's what really captured my attention. I have a number of very, very excellent PhD psychologists in my district. And those folks have settled in Eastern Oregon. They love it. They love to live there. And actually, some of them have expressed a real strong interest in going back and receiving their training in pharmacology so that they could do this to be of greater assistance to a larger outreach. This is something that would provide a tremendous opportunity for advancement, both in income as well as outreach. These folks are very, very interested in this kind of approach, that Oregon would become another state in addition to the other two states to add this additional service. And because of the rural nature of much of Oregon, recognizing that three-quarters of the state of Oregon on the other side of the mountains is extremely rural. We're still less than the 1810 definition of frontier counties in much of that area. So this is very rural country, and these psychologists who have PhD psychologists like Dr. Barnard who have come there are anxious and willing to go back and further their education. And remember, Oregon, through the Oregon State University, has an excellent School of Pharmacology.
Yes, follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair, and perhaps a comment. I think that as I've just kind of scanned through some of the opposition letter that addresses that perhaps this is a very limited scope, because there really are, while we're trying to address rural issues, there it might not be as significant a problem as it is being addressed. So it might be interesting to see for areas that are of the rural nature to see what the supply of psychologists are in those areas, to see if that would be an enhancement for those communities.
I think that's an excellent point, and I think we'll hear some testimony on those numbers. So,
right.
Thank you. Other questions for the representatives? Thank you. Well, we really... Oh, Representative Gelson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank Representative Butler for recognizing the strength of the College of Pharmacology at Oregon State University.
And Madam Chair, I do have a couple of conflicts of interest which I need to get on the record. Dr. John Lowe Butler IV is the former Dean of Psychiatric Medicine at the University of Oregon, and he still is living. John Lowe Butler VI, who just was admitted into a PhD program in psychology, is a potential beneficiary of this in another 5 or 6 years when he finishes his PhD.
Thank you for noting
those
that.
Those be relatives.
Note that for the record. Thank you, representatives, for being here. And may I
add, Madam Chair, that I will not, if this bill passes, not be sitting for the certificate.
Thank you, representatives. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing temporarily on 2800. Just want to show professional courtesy to the representatives. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2650. Colleagues, we have before us some amendments for 2650. My intent is to make some amendments and move this bill to the full committee today. And Cindy with Legislative Council is here in case we have any questions about the amendments that you've received. I don't think we need a review of the bill. We've had two public hearings on this and a work session. So let's just go through the amendments before us. Start off with the dash. I'm just going to review them real quickly. We have the dash two amendments, which address an issue that was raised by testimony regarding the vitamin and mineral content of the juices. We'll be deleting that. The dash six amendments address some committee concerns about clarifying the definition of entree and snack in the bill, as well as dealing with the blended school issue about what would be the calorie requirement depending on the grade. The dash eight deal with, this is a new one that we haven't seen before today. This is dealing with timelines, and I have some questions for Cindy about it. And the dash nines, which deal with, that were drafted after a conversation with the Oregon Soft Drink Association, but my intention is not to move the dash nine today because I placed at your desks a copy of a letter that I received today, a memo from the Oregon Soft Drink Association about a change around the beverage requirements for high school that they would like to see. And this is in alignment with the Alliance for a Healthier Generation standards. These new standards are coming out in about 2 weeks. So the reason the dash nines are drafted, that is the existing language for the Alliance for a Healthier Generation for high school beverage requirements. What is contained in the memo with the Oregon Soft Drink Association is the coming language. And so I've had a conversation with them that we could amend the bill with that language, and they have expressed their support for the bill if we make those changes. So what I was hoping is that we could deal with amendments around the beverage issue on Friday in the full committee, if that would be okay with folks, because we don't have those drafted yet.
Madam Chair.
That was a quick summary, so Representative Greenley?
It would probably be useful if the subcommittee expressed an opinion on the dash nines.
Absolutely.
We would try and have ready so that, I mean, you can't conceptually accept them, the notion that if the committee really recommends them, then we can have them ready and zip them right in on Friday.
That makes sense. So I thought maybe we'll go back through one at a time and see if we can do some motions on each one as we go and then answer some questions about them, if that works for everybody, unless there's some general questions at this point. So on the dash twos.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I would move the dash two amendments to House Bill 2650.
Thank you. There's been a motion to amend 2650 with the dash two amendments. Any discussion? Hearing no objections, so moved. Dash twos have been added to 2650. The dash six amendments.
Madam Chair, I would move the dash six amendments to House Bill 2650.
Thank you, Representative Bruin. There's been a motion to move the dash six amendments to House Bill 2650. Any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, so moved.
Madam Chair, I would move the dash eight amendment to House Bill 2650.
Thank you. There's been a motion to move the dash eight amendments to 2650, and this is where I have a question for Cindy around these. The intent on the dash eights was to do two things. Representative Gelser, would you like to talk about them? This is your amendment.
Yes.
So,
thank you.
Please do.
So my intent in requesting these were two things. One, that an implementation date of July 1st of this year wasn't especially practical for school boards given their own noticing requirements and their process for adopting new policies. So moving that to 2008-2009. And then to provide a little bit more time to address some of those issues of the interplay between the federally subsidized lunch and the entree line, and also allowing school districts. Many school districts don't have a nutritionist or a dietitian on staff, which would make it very difficult for them to immediately adjust and change the way that they were cooking, basically, and putting ingredients together. And in an effort not to have those resources come out of the classroom by hiring consultants to do this on a very expedited timeline, giving an extra year for that to happen would allow those districts that were ready to move forward, and it would provide a little bit more time for other districts to come up to speed. And that would, the intent was for that only to impact that delay would only be for grades 9 through 12, for those a la carte, for those items that were in the a la carte line, and that immediately in 08-09, regardless of the grade, everything that was prepackaged would start, whether that was a prepackaged Rice Krispie treat or cookie or prepackaged yogurt, or if it was a prepackaged mini pizza that they were heating up. The distinction was where I think Janet Beer used that description of mixing two ingredients together, where the school district is mixing the ingredients together, creating the delay for that.
Mm-hmm. Chair Kotek, Representative Gelser, I think these amendments only go about 90% to where you want.
Okay.
So what they do is a couple of things. They do delay the effective date for the whole bill to July 1, 08, from July 1, 07. So I think that's the first thing that you mentioned. So they do that, first of all. But then secondly, they delay the implementation date for entree and snack items prepared on-site and sold individually until July 1, 09. And I think that's the second thing that you mentioned. The thing that they don't do is that applies, all of these dates that I just mentioned, applies to K-12. It's not limited just to 9-12. So that's the part that I don't think that these address.
Thank you for that clarification, because I didn't totally catch that either, and we had this discussion. It was trying to address the concern, particularly in the high schools, because that is where the bulk of the on-site prepared a la carte issue is happening. So we had attended high school, so I don't know if that's one issue. The other thing I was wondering about on these particular amendments, and I apologize for it, it's funny, you read them and then you read them again and you have questions. So one of the concerns I have is I want to make sure that even though we implement this for the 08-09 school year, I would have, and this is particularly around vending contracts, for example, I wouldn't want to see a school enter into a contract in 2007 that would lock them in to a less restrictive product mix, and then the bill comes into place for the 08 school year. Because I think the intent is, this is a public health issue. We want to make sure that there's not, you know, an option to stick in a beverage contract that will lock the schools into something that doesn't comply with the bill.
Yeah.
And so I don't know if Representative Gelson?
I think that my... I can see where that concern comes from, but I think that given that this bill will be passing and school districts will see this coming down the pike, I, as a former school board member, certainly I would rather take care of it when we do a new contract rather than having to deal with it later down the line. So I don't think there would be a tremendous incentive for school districts to try to sneak it under the line. I think what we heard in testimony is vendors don't care what they're selling out of the machines. They just want to sell out of the machines. Districts are going to have an incentive to comply rather than having to go through what would essentially be a third round of compliance and change if we're changing the mixed or the on-site prepared foods in 09 and we're doing this in 08 and then they've got their snacks are switched over but not their beverages until after that. I would be surprised if it became an issue.
And so just a clarification, lines 7, 8, and 9, does that address that?
Chair Kotek, it does, but it does say that it only applies to contracts entered into or extended after the effective date, and the effective date in these amendments are July 1, 08.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, there's nothing, as Representative Gelster was saying, there was nothing that would stop a school district from adopting these standards early and reflecting that in their contracts, certainly. But technically, they wouldn't have to until July 1 of 08.
Representative Gelser, then Greenick, and then Bottom Beach.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay. And I think I may have answered.
I just want to make sure you had your hand up. Okay, sorry. Representative Gelser,
Greenick. I just wanted to point out that the other thing is if you think about the timeline of a school district and when it enters into contracts, it's for the course of a school year. So the likelihood of entering in the middle of a school year is not very likely, so I think that even that effective date is going to take care of that. If they entered into a contract for the 07-08 school year, that would be in July of 07, but a contract for the 08-09 school year would be in the summer of 2008. So I think just because of the structure of a school calendar, I think that also probably addresses that issue.
It could. I guess I'm worried about multi-year contracts. But I understand your point there that it wouldn't make sense, but it doesn't necessarily preclude it. Representative Greenwood?
I think it is precluded. Doesn't it say on line 7 or 8 that this act applies to contracts entered into or extended after the effective date of this act? And because of the emergency clause, the effective date of this act is July 1st, 2007.
Chair Kotek, Representative Greenlick, under the Dash 8 amendments, the effective date is extended to July 1, 08, on line 21 of the Dash 8 amendments. Yeah. In the original bill, the effective date was July 1, 07.
Oh, we may not want Section 3.
Representative Bonamici?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my concern was if there is such a thing as a multi-year contract that was entered into before the effective date. And I see that in the original bill in Section 2, Paragraph 2, it seems to address that issue by saying that the school district operating under a contract entered into before the effective date shall comply with the standards required by Section 1 to the greatest extent allowed under that contract. And I just am concerned about whether the amendments are consistent with that. And what happens if there's an existing contract?
Mm-hmm. Chair Kotek, Representative Bonamici, the section that you referred to is also in the Dash 8 amendments, and it's contained in lines 17 to 20. Mm-hmm. And it talks about if a school district's operating under a contract and entered into before the effective date, so in these amendments, that's July 1, 08, the school district must comply with the standards to the greatest extent allowed under the contract. The problem is that if you have a contract that's entered into, let's say, for example, June 30th of 07 or 08, the day before the effective date, this subsection 3 isn't the law yet. It has no effect. So that existing contract, the school district gets to operate under it, and then on July 1 of 08, to the greatest extent allowed under the contract, they need to comply with this bill until that contract runs out.
Madam Chair.
Representative Greenwich.
Yeah. Where did Section 3, why did Section 3 add it to the Dash 8?
Madam Representative Gelser?
Yes, Section 3 is added to that because it would be very difficult for a school district to implement something on July 1st of 2007, which is only 3 months from now. For a school district to adopt a policy, they have to appoint a work group. They have to have notice for a first reading. There has to be a whole month between the first and the second reading, and then the second and the third reading before they can vote on it. So just under public meetings laws and the way that that type of government operates, they could not do that. I also proposed this in that Section 3, moving the effective date upwards. I just don't think it's reasonable to expect all of the school districts in the state, many of whom this will be a substantial change, to do that within 2 months of the time it's probably signed by the governor.
If I could just jump in here, the intent of the bill was to not ask school districts, going back to the original bill, what Representative Bonamici mentioned, is that we didn't want to penalize schools who are already in contracts prior to any implementation of the bill. I think we do have an issue about the intent for future contracts that we have that gray space between what we pass and when this actually gets implemented. So I think we should maybe huddle and talk about these amendments before Friday again on the timeline issue, if that would be all right, because I'm guessing there's some issues on this one that we should probably...
But if we just clarify just a little bit more. I mean, it would be possible to put, as we have in Section 2A of the Dash 8s, it talks about when the effective date, when the implementation date takes place, and in that case it says the implementation date takes place not until the 2008-2009 school year, and still have the act itself taking force on July 1st of 2007, right? And if we needed to do that for Section 2 of the act, you could do it the same way. I mean, there's a difference between, I mean, it seems it's very important that it says contracts that happen before the effective date are excluded, and it seems very important to me to make sure the effective date is July 1st, 2007, which would mean any contract entered into after that time would apply. These standards would apply. It seems to me that you can put off the implementation date of when the school districts have to get into compliance and not put off the effective date of the bill. Is that not right?
Chair Kotek, Representative Greenlich, if I understood you correctly, if you have the bill applying to the contract starting on July 1/07, you're effectively telling the districts to implement the bill on July 1/07.
And
that's a policy choice for the committee to make.
You're not. You're only telling
them. I think the intent of Representative Gelser's amendment is to allow for some planning time at the school level on the implementation.
Right.
My issue is about not having school districts enter into contracts that could somehow supersede what we're really trying to intend to do. And I think, and we didn't really talk about that because we didn't think about it. But the goal is not to burden the schools will have a year to implement. Mm-hmm. The question is making sure they don't enter into something that they'll have to stick with once the bill actually happens.
Right.
I don't know if that makes any sense.
Chair Kotek, I have a suggestion.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what you could do is you could, the bill would take effect July 1/07. The implementation would be delayed, but you could tell the school districts not to enter into a contract in that year that would extend beyond July 1/08 and not be in compliance with the standards in the bill.
Okay.
That wouldn't cover contracts that they had entered in before July 1/07, but knowing that they probably don't have contracts that extend very far out, it would cover most of their contracts.
Thank you. I think that's helpful. So I'm going to use Chair's prerogative here and pull back the motion for Dash 8s, and we're going to talk about it. But I see heads nodding about that suggestion, the sense of we want to delay implementation, but we can talk offline before Friday, and we can work on some amendments if that is okay. But, you know, the general intent is to have some delay, but to make sure that what happens after that start date is what we're talking about in the bill. Representative
Gelson. Madam Chair, thank you. And I appreciate the intent and the concern. I just would want to to ensure that the plan is to move forward with that delay in implementation date, and I think that I'll probably have to withhold my support until we're able to do that in the full committee. And the other is I think that we're fairly clear in the intent of what we're doing, and I just want to be careful about the way that we
talk about it. I don't have a lack of trust of the local school districts to comply with the law, and I don't think that that's what's being conveyed here either, and so I'm hopeful that there's a way that we can go and address that in another way. But I do think that if we pass a bill and we make a law, school districts are local governments, and they're going to want to comply with the law. That's for all of those school board members. They take an oath of office, as we do, to uphold the Constitution and the laws of the state. And so I think we need to address it so that people aren't unintentionally entering into contracts, but I wouldn't want us to, for our committee, to suggest that we think that school districts are going to intentionally go around to violate the intent of the law. And I don't hear that as what you're saying.
At all. Well, thank you for that perspective, Representative. Okay. Representative Bruhn, would you be willing to withdraw?
Absolutely.
The dash 8? Okay. So what we have right now is we've passed the dash 2 and dash 6. So on the dash 9 amendments, like I mentioned at the start, we have a different set of amendments. We have a different amendment around the beverage issue, so I was hoping we could deal with that in the full committee on Friday. Discussion about this in terms of the memo from the Soft Drinks Association, any comments? My principle here is consistency with the Alliance for a Healthier Generation. By the way, if anybody has cell phones on or Blackberries, could you turn them off, please? Thank you. Representative Flores.
Madam Chair, I guess I have a question on your intent then. We have dash 8 amendments that we're going to withhold and bring, not deal with in this subcommittee, but bring to the full committee, and potentially the determination on the dash 9s that we're not going to deal with in this subcommittee and potentially bring to the full committee. So are we... is this bill fully been through our subcommittee process when we have these amendments still outstanding?
I appreciate that. I would like to move this, and we've had a lot of discussion. I realize that this particular one is last minute, but it's not substantially different from the dash 9s. There was a discussion around doing something around the beverages. Okay. So I'm just, if there's some discussion around not only the timeline or the beverage, if I get a sense of the group, I would like to move this. Representative Greenlink, do we need, we have to pass something on to the full, is that correct?
Yes, you need to move it on to the full. You could, if you desire, move it on to the full without a recommendation. I mean, you have a chance to move it on to the full with a due pass recommendation, move it on to the full without a recommendation, it seems to me if there's consensus about what you're trying to do, and I sense that there is consensus about what you're trying to do, and the amendments come in enough time for everybody to look at them to do exactly that, it shouldn't be a problem handling them on Friday.
Thank you, Representative. The other option, Cindy, do you think we could have rewrites of on the implementation dates and the beverage by Thursday if we want to work this on Thursday?
Chair Kotek, yes.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. In deference to folks on the committee to work this here in our sub, we could do it on Thursday.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate that consideration. I will express that I'm concerned that when I hear that we need to move these things to accomplish a certain time frame without having the issues fully resolved in the committee, which is responsible for them, it troubles me. So I appreciate your consideration that we could address these once again at our Thursday committee.
I'd prefer that as well, Madam Chair.
Bonamici? Okay. Representative Gelson?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would prefer that. It's my desire to support this bill, and I would like the opportunity to add those
absolutely
in so that I can add my voices.
Absolutely. And some of these were last minute, and that's right. The way it goes, but I'd rather have us all in agreement before we move it on to the full committee. So I just publicly make note that we will work session this, carry it over to Thursday.
Are you going to accept 2 and 6?
2 and 6 have been accepted. So what we'll be discussing then is the implementation and the beverage issue on Thursday. And with that, we'll close the work session on 2650. Thank you for the discussion, committee members. And let's open a public hearing again on House Bill 2800. So Sandy is... summarize the bill. We've heard from the chief co-sponsors, and the way I would like to run this is we are going to start off with a three-person panel of the proponents of House Bill 2800. Then we will follow that, and the panel there would be Lindsay, Grover, and Connor. And then they will be followed by a panel of opponents, McCulley, Lace, and Winters. And then we will go back through the list of proponents and the list of opponents. And the intent is to get through as much of this today as we can, so I would encourage folks to be brief and not repeat what other folks have said. And so I'd like to call up Linnea Lindsay, Peter Grover, and James Connor to the dais, please. It's come to my attention Mr. Lace might have to leave at 4 o'clock, so the second panel might want to think about a replacement for Mr. Lace or Dr. Lace. If he has to leave, I'm not sure we'll get to him before he has to go. So just announce yourself. Sure. Are we ready? Yes, but
I'm just introducing the written testimony.
Okay, thank you.
That's it. All right, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Betsy Earls, representing the Oregon Psychological Association. Thank you for hearing House Bill 2800 today. We are, of course, appearing in support. I don't have any substantive testimony myself, but we had a great deal of written testimony from people who are supporters of House Bill 2800 who are not able to attend, and I just wanted to tell you what you're getting handed out to you, and then I'll get out of the way and let the real show begin. We have testimony from Tina Castaneras, who is a family practice doctor in Hood River. We have testimony from Russ Newman, who is the executive director for professional practice at the American Psychological Association. Dr. Robin Henson, who is an obstetrician gynecologist from Hood River. Dr. Robert Julian, anesthesiologist and educator in psychotropic medications up at OHSU. We have testimony from James Morse, who is a PhD student at George Fox, and I believe Mr. Morse is actually appearing himself today, but you have his testimony now. Let's see, Dr. Robert Zielinski from Hermiston, Oregon, who's an internal medicine specialist. Dr. Robert McGrath, a psychologist in Oregon. We have a couple of letters that I think will be of interest to you because they are from other states that have already implemented this legislation. Scott Eckholt from Louisiana, Mario Marquez from Albuquerque, New Mexico, and Glenn Alley from Louisiana. The other pieces that you are looking at there are from Dr. Trey Riggert, who is a doctor specializing in pain management in Hood River, and from a licensed counselor named Michael Stevens, who is also in Hood River. Okay. Now I will get out of the way. Thank you, Ms. Earls. And we have all that. We're just collating it differently.
Right. So.
You can do whatever order that you've got prepared. Yes, but I.
Yeah, okay.
I should bring my
PowerPoint up.
Hello, I'm Dr. Linnea Lindsay. I'm from Hood River, Oregon, and I'm trying to get my PowerPoint to work. Apologize for the delay here.
Does someone else want to start first?
To do that, right into the audience.
Got it?
There we go. I thank the you for this opportunity to speak to you today. I've lived and worked in Hood River for the last 15 years as a clinical psychologist, although my most important job is being parent to my three children. I have an expectation that brains are a very important thing. I always say we're going to survive my children's childhood if we don't have a traumatic brain injury, so I'm a great proponent of helmets. But I think that today, speaking on behalf of House Bill 2800, it is about brains. It is about people. It is about successful childhoods and adulthoods. Psychology is my second career. I am an ordained minister in the United Church of Christ with 7 years of parish ministry experience.
As a minister, I experienced over and over again the need for psychological and physical health and support of the human spirit. I spent 5 years as a volunteer chaplain to an AIDS HIV program and spent a long time working with people who could not get the services they need. So I went back to school. I became a clinical psychologist because it was about serving people at a level that they needed. With my new PhD, I moved to Hood River. Oh, I didn't know what rural health care was going to be like. I landed in the Columbia River Gorge, and I was hired to run an intensive outpatient program for a hospital in Portland that had a satellite in Hood River. In that program, every person needed history and physical. They needed to be seen for their physical health as well as their mental health. Did you know that a person can die from alcohol withdrawal, not opioid withdrawal? And if someone's detoxing on an outpatient basis, I was the one who had to watch them, to follow them, to work with them. Fortunately, early on in psychology, I learned to look for physiological signs along with mental health issues. Look for somebody who might have neglect of one side or who had unequal pupils, jaundice indicating they might have some liver function problems, profuse sweating that might be low blood sugar, or maybe some social phobia. Slurred speech might mean they're intoxicated or having a stroke or just very nervous. It would have been impossible for me to practice psychology all these years without a working knowledge of medical science. Otherwise, I might be treating a patient for depression and they had a brain tumor, or for anxiety and they had a thyroid condition. Human beings come as one package, and we must be observant of all those possible diagnoses, including mental and physical health diagnoses. Is it dementia or is it Lyme's disease? Collaborating healthcare with a primary care provider is the only way I know and believe that it is this imperative in mental health care. I've been on the hospital staff at Hood River Hospital for over a decade. I've worked collaboratively with the physicians there for a long time. They call me and say, I've got this patient who has bugs crawling under their skin. What am I going to do? How do I deal with this? And we would discuss how to handle it both psychologically and with what medications they might suggest for that patient. I've learned a lot working collaboratively, and I know that it is working together that we need to do things. Through the years, I've heard over and over again about the lack of a psychiatrist and the gratitude of my local primary care physicians at having a psychologist, somebody who had training in dual diagnosis, and was willing to share with them in providing care. My intensive outpatient job only lasted a year and a half. Mergers and healthcare kind of change things every once in a while. And so a colleague of mine and I went to the CEO of the Hood River Hospital and asked if they wanted some drug and alcohol services and perhaps some mental health services. Well, 11 and a half years later, after developing the program for the hospital, adding other psychologists, adding a child psychiatrist, adding a social worker who worked in geriatrics and veterans medicine, I've worked over the years trying to provide programs and services in Hood River. But we've always had trouble having a psychiatrist. Dr. Chambers, our only psychiatrist in Hood River County who works for the hospital, is child and adolescent, and she came 7 years ago. Nobody else has come since then to provide psychiatric care at that level. Hood River may just seem like it's down the road, but I can tell you when I-84 is closed, we're like a world apart. We don't have trauma surgeons. We don't have people to provide psychiatric services. We don't have adult psychiatrists, psychiatric nurse practitioners. There's no psychiatric hospital beds. There's no emergency department social workers. There's no one who can do that work on a regular basis in our hospital. I've practiced there 15 years. It's been something where we ended up with law enforcement. We have to transport people. Law enforcement has to take somebody to Pendleton. It takes resources. It takes time. It exhausts people. The lesson was and is that we worked together, and we all had to step up to the plate with our knowledge. I spent time learning more about psychiatric medicines. I did the kind of satellite telecourses, grand rounds in psychiatry. But eventually I knew it wasn't enough. It just wasn't enough. I've studied science all my life and known about medicine, but I also knew that psychology and the education that I had was not sufficient. I knew, once again, it was time to go back to school. And so 3.5 years ago, I did. I enrolled in the Alliant program in psychopharmacology, and that's what I'd like to tell you about. Primary care are the de facto mental health providers in my county, and they spend up to 25% of their time providing medicine. Right now in Hood River, there's only, in the Gorge, where there are over 100,000 people, there's only three practicing psychiatrists. There's a nurse practitioner, she's leaving, and there's only, the two psychiatrists work for county mental health, and the one is at the hospital. 60% of rural Americans live in a mental health professional shortage area. I live in one of those places. 65% of rural Americans get their mental health care from their primary care provider. Could be 6 weeks, 6 months. I talked to a vice provost at OSU, and they said sometimes they only have a psychiatrist 4 hours a week for the 18,000 students at our university. Surgeon General says less than one-third of people with diagnosable mental disorders receive treatment in a year. The qualifications for an Oregon psychologist to obtain a degree in psychotropics are written into House Bill 2800. Is to get an approved postdoctoral master's degree, to do a year of supervised clinical practicum, and to pass a national certifying exam. The focus of the educational program is this. This goes along with the APA's new guidelines. It's about adopting a program of competency, integrating didactic and supervised clinical experiences. This is only a postdoctoral degree. It is not for anybody who is currently a doctoral student. All of us who've done the degree program here in Oregon probably have at least probably 10 years of clinical experience under our belts before we decide to move this direction. We work on issues of diversity, diversity of population, diversity of diseases, diversity of combinations, diversity of where somebody lives and what their resources are. There's a capstone competency, knowing for sure we know what we know at a clinical level. All the programs that would be under the auspices of APA have to have a designation, like an approval process. And there must be a lifetime commitment to maintaining these competencies. The competencies are these: physical exam, review of systems, medical history, assessment, differential diagnosis, integrated treatment planning, consultation, collaboration, and treatment management. These are the kind of educational courses that I completed. My first year was just about ramping up on hard science. A very important part of my education was knowing that I needed to do this, and that that was something that was not, it was a part of my training, but was not as substantial as I needed it to be. This training that we have, biochemistry, neurochemistry, neuroanatomy, neurophysiology, pharmacology, psychopharmacology, all was about adding to somebody's degree who is already studied psychology, already worked together with patients, and firmly planting for them a foundation around medical issues integrated with physical issues. One of the most important parts of House Bill 2800 is this idea of working collaboratively long term. It is our commitment to work with the medical professionals who have expertise. This is a practice done all the time in the medical profession. If you need a neurologist or you need a specialist in dermatology, you go to a specialist. And people know how to refer when they need to refer. And we are committed to doing that. The other day, a friend asked me why I would do this if I'm not going to make any more money, and there is no guarantee that any of us will make any more money. And I said, in my county, it's the right thing to do. You need to know in my county it would make the difference that the child psychiatrist could see only children. She has to carry the burden for the whole county right now. It would mean that the primary care physicians could spend time with the patients in the way that they need them. That is the most important thing that I can do for my community, is to step up to the plate and provide this educational opportunity, this education and this training combined to be able to help people move forward. Thank you for this opportunity to speak with you.
Thank you, Dr. Lindsay. Could we get a copy of your PowerPoint? Because that would be
certainly
for the committee. That would be great. Thank you. And did you want to, was someone going to talk about this document?
Yeah. Oh, I didn't know you had that.
Oh, we just got passed out.
The document that you have in your hand I'd love to speak to today is to answer the question about how our program is substantial. And one of the questions that continues to be asked is, why would we not train to become psychiatric mental health nurse practitioners? in juxtaposition with why we chose the specialized program that we have. I've done my best in that to lay out for you kind of side by side what their training program is. Theirs is after their bachelor's degree, they pursue this master's degree. We're talking about after we've done a bachelor's, master's courses on the way to a doctorate, and this is added on after that. We are about 11 or 12 years into an education by the time we finish this. So some of the programs issues that they have are redundant to research design, how to write a paper, kind of look at data. But the pieces that lay side by side are the pieces about hard science, clinical medicine. They have about 110 hours of pharmacology. We have about 194 hours of pharmacology. We need that kind of training. We need to be robust. We need to be rigorous. We need to have it be an impeccable degree program added to what we do. We are not nurses. We are psychologists.
Thank you. Representative Greenlee.
Your background. Where is this course given?
The one that I took.
The one you're referring to here in this.
That is the Oregon Health Sciences University School of Nursing Psychiatric Mental Health Nurse Practitioner Program.
Where's ours?
Ours?
Yours.
Our program is with Alliant, and the program that I participated in was at the Kingstad Center next to Nike. It's done on an executive seminar basis, and it's done via live satellite with professors from Alliant International University, and it was didactic. They could see us. We could talk to them. They could talk to us. Every third weekend, we'd go for 12 hours, and we'd study. And integrated into that, we were clinically practicing at the same time, so we were applying everything we learned to the clinical practices we did concurrently.
If I may follow.
Yes.
Does Alliant meet the definition that's in the bill of being a regional, of being an institution accredited by a regional accreditation organization?
Alliant International University has been approved by the Association of Schools and Colleges and has been authorized to offer the psychopharmacology program in Oregon by the Oregon Office of Degree Authorization. Yes.
By which organization?
The Oregon Office of Degree Authorization.
Before that?
It's the Associations of School and Colleges, the Western WASC.
The Western. Thank you.
And thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. So that was on page 2, the lines that are talking about the program, lines 9 through 12, about accreditation. Thank you for I just didn't want to cut you off, but thank you on that. So we have some coursework comparison. Other questions for Dr. Lindsay? Thank you. Let's move on. Either one.
Sure. Go ahead. Yes, positive. Go ahead. Madam Chair and fellow representatives, having the opportunity to address this assembled group this afternoon is not only an honor, but it is a privilege. My name is James Connor, and I am 21 years old and reside in Tigard, Oregon. And speaking before such an influential group at my age is something not many people get to experience. I hope that in my case, the words and stories I'm about to share with you don't fall on deaf ears, but rather on open hearts. Today's youth have pressures influencing their lives from all possible angles. Pressures ranging from adolescent smoking to teenage pregnancy, from drug use to suicide, and all the other pressures you as legislators think you know about, except for one. How about the pressure of growing up in a house where you're not sure whether this is the day your brother will kill himself, kill a family member, or kill you? Ladies and gentlemen, from the time I was 11 years old, my oldest brother, Chris, who's now 38, has been living at home. I wouldn't go as far as to say by choice, but rather by force, because of the absolutely pitiful mental health program, not only in Washington County, where we live, but across the state. I had just walked home from another rough day of being accused and called gay and getting teased because I wasn't one of the cool kids wearing the Abercrombie & Fitch during the hellish years of middle school. I got home and was about to find my salvation in the one thing I had after each day of school, and that was turning on the Rosie O'Donnell show just to make me laugh again. When I heard the phone ring, it was an Asian person, and I thought it was a prank call or something, so I hung up. A minute later, they called back. Still thinking it was a prank call, I hung up again. That was it. No more calls. The night went by, and I finally was in bed. And my mom came in frantically and said, "Did anybody call from the Tarn Tip?" the Tarn Tip being a restaurant in Corvallis where Chris washed dishes. I said no, not thinking anything of it, and went to bed. Come to find out, the phone calls the afternoon weren't pranks. They were Chris's boss trying to inform us of what had happened. He noticed that Chris had split his wrists and was extremely pale. So he rushed Chris up to the hospital, where he was immediately rushed into the ER and then ultimately taken up to the mental health ward. I was 11 years old, and my brother had just attempted suicide. Or how about the story that came 2 weeks later? Chris had just been released from the hospital that afternoon. It was my mom, dad, and I that spent the entire morning gutting out and cleaning his entire apartment, which he had been urinating into pots and jars, had food everywhere, and endless bottles of beer. We got everything cleaned up and then picked up Chris. Trying to decide on where we wanted to go for lunch, my mom and dad got into a bit of an argument as to where they wanted to go, so we settled on Chinese. Chris sat silently and ate nothing. We dropped him off at his apartment and said our goodbyes, and we made our drive back up to home in Tigard, which was just under 2 hours, because we let my dad drive. But that was plenty of time. Plenty of time for what, you ask? Well, when we walked in the front door, it was customary to check the answering machine. Sure enough, Chris was back up at the hospital. He had jumped off the third story of his apartment complex and shattered every bone in his body from the tips of his toes to his pelvis. He has countless rods and screws in him, and I don't want to venture to guess how long it took to be fully healed from this one. That was the kicker. We knew from then on that he could not live in that apartment, and found that our house would be a safe, temporary location until we could find a group home. It's been 11 years, but that's a whole different topic in itself. My friends, I am here today addressing you as a citizen, as a brother, and as a man who's grown up through his years of puberty with a clinically diagnosed, depressed, and paranoid schizophrenic brother. You're all smart people, so in case you need a respectful reminder, schizophrenia is defined as social isolation, intellectual deterioration, and emotional bluntness. This is not something that we as humans can cure or solve. Each person's case is entirely different, and I accept that. What I cannot and will not accept, though, is any further blatant disrespect shown our family from the people in the mental health field, getting wealthy off our money and providing nothing in return. My family has been bounced around through countless psychiatrists for the past 11 years, countless mental health programs, and worst of all, been placed off and on thousands of dollars worth of medications. Not any one of his countless psychiatrists has made an attempt to get to know Chris and what exactly he needs. I mentioned that the issue of housing was an entirely different topic, but I feel compelled to share this one quick story with you. A year and a half ago, we thought we had things working in our favor and that we had a good psychiatrist helping us out, someone who had been looking at some potential group homes for Chris that we could visit. The psychiatrist, who we thought was taking time during his 15-minute appointment once every 4 months if we were lucky. Yes, members of the board, I did just say 15 minutes once every 4 months. Regardless, my mom and I were the ones who ventured out to research this group home in Washington County. My mom took time to share many of Chris's fears and things that would agitate him to the psychiatrist. She told him on multiple occasions that Chris is paranoid about being incinerated and then spread to the dogs. We got out to this house in Beaverton, and my mom and I looked at each other and just about turned around. This doctor had the audacity to tell my family of this great house in Beaverton where the care was superb and the clients would welcome Chris well. What he failed to mention was how this house was right next door to a funeral home and crematorium. Right next door. Not a block away or around the corner, but literally a chain link fence away. The house attendant jokingly said that often the people would find ashes outside and begin carrying on conversation with them, asking them who they were and if they enjoyed being incinerated. You must be outside your mind if you think my mom and I are going to place my brother in a care home like this. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. once said, "The good neighbor looks beyond the external accidents and discerns those inner qualities that make all men human, and therefore brothers. He also said that the ultimate measure of a man is not where he stands in moments of comfort, but where he stands at times of challenge and controversy.
Mr. Connor, I just want to say I'm finding your testimony very compelling. I also know that we have it in written form, and I want to make sure we get through as many people today. Would it be possible to summarize the remaining couple pages, if that's possible? And I hate to cut you off, but we can read this, but I just...
It's fine. Go ahead. You can read it.
Particularly as it relates to the bill.
It's cool. Yeah. You can read it. Madam Chairman, you can read it. It's in form.
No, Mr. Connor, I want to know how this relates to the bill. And I know there's a point, and so I want to make sure you get a chance to say that. If it's just a particular paragraph.
Madam Chair, my family has been bounced around through the mental health program in the state.
Mm-hmm.
Like I say in here, like a fisherman's bobber.
Mm-hmm. And I know that you know that House Bill 2800 would help your family. I guess I just want to know what that is. I know you can say that without reading
it. Please understand that this is a very emotional topic because I've grown up through this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very passionate about this. I'm sorry that even now we don't have the time to take the 10 minutes to listen to a family member's perspective on this. How this would help is it's going to ensure that my brother, when I leave, because I will leave at some point, what this will do is this will ensure that my family can rest easy because they have a psychologist who will work with them. Someone who will give my brother, who will give my family more than 15 minutes once every 4 months and not change every 6 months.
That's perfect. Thank you. Dr. Grover.
Madam Chair and the committee, thanks for the opportunity to speak in favor of House Bill 2800. I'm a psychologist licensed in the state of Oregon and a member of the Oregon Psychological Association. I currently work as the clinical supervisor for the adult inpatient psychiatric unit at St. Vincent Hospital. And I completed the postdoctoral master's degree in psychopharmacology. As the people who testified before me have stated, House Bill 2800 helps to provide access to the expanded mental health care made available by Oregon's mental health parity law. It also allows people to obtain comprehensive mental health care from a single provider without duplicated visits or copayments. Access to comprehensive mental health treatment is a problem I see every day. I'll try and summarize this since we are trying to be good with our time. People that we routinely discharge from the hospital, even in the Portland metropolitan area, for the example person I was going to talk about, the soonest we were able to find an appointment for her was in 5 weeks following a hospital discharge when she'd had a near lethal suicide attempt. We were able to find her a psychologist appointment within about a week of her leaving the hospital. With House Bill 2800, she would have been able to get access to all of her treatment, both the psychopharmacology and the psychotherapy in one place in a sooner time. The other thing I wanted to address was when you hear people discuss this bill in opposition, typically when I've heard that in the past, they speak directly to people's fears. And I'm concerned about safety, as are all of my colleagues. But when the degree program, as Dr. Lindsay pointed out, contains a foundation in basic sciences and then in the specialized parts of medicine that would help us safely be able to do this work. In your consideration of the bill, I just encourage you to look beyond the fear to the facts, and I appreciate that you're taking the time to carefully consider the educational program. And in terms of some facts, there's a recent review article that found that there's an absence of studies in the literature that demonstrate that the practice of non-physician healthcare providers is in any way less satisfactory than that of physicians. In fact, they found that it's more common to find evidence that the addition of non-physician practitioners to a treatment team enhances patient satisfaction. Prescribing psychologists already have a track record of safety, as you've heard from the Department of Defense Project and the other states that have practiced this. Tens of thousands of prescriptions have been written by psychologists without any adverse events. So I think that's enough said about that. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Dr. Grover. I'd like to follow up on a point raised by Mr. Connor. Can you explain to me the way that psychologists provide care versus psychiatrists? I'm very struck by this 15-minute appointment issue that Mr. Connor so eloquently spoke to. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
I can address that some. a typical psychologist treatment plan includes weekly psychotherapy meetings. The core of the way that we like to practice is to get to know the person and all of the issues that they're concerned about and try and develop a comprehensive treatment plan that addresses them. Often, that includes referring them to someone for a medication evaluation, be that a specialist like a psychiatrist or a primary care physician. So, but in that ongoing treatment, in the outpatients that I see, I routinely ask them every week that they come in, how is the medication working for you? Are you experiencing any side effects? If they raise those under my current scope of practice, I say, well, let's make sure that during your next appointment with your psychiatrist, which with my client is 3 months away, let's make sure that that gets addressed. So we're already tracking and working with that in our current scope of practice in this ongoing relationship where we know them and see them for an extended period of time. And I think that's a higher standard of care that we'd like to be able to practice.
Thank you. So I see a list of questions. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll be very brief because I know there's a lot of people waiting. Mr. Connor, thank you for being here. I don't want you to go away thinking that we won't read and consider the rest of your testimony. Was your brother seeing psychologists?
No. He's been bounced in and out of psychiatrists for the past 10 years.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you. I had a question and a comment. Thank you, Madam Chair. When a psychologist sees an individual, do they meet with the family? Are there any services for families when they're through a psychologist when they're dealing with complex mental health issues to look at the needs of every person in the family?
In my private practice and when I practice for the hospital, if there were an issue that affected the family, certainly we would work with the patient and invite the family in. If there were need for more social services kind of issues, then I would often refer them to a social service agency that could more comprehensively, or social work services that might be able to do that. But certainly we are trained in family therapy and to assess those issues, and it happens quite frequently because it is a family issue.
Right. Thank you. Follow up. And I just wanted to bring that out and really thank you, Mr. Connor, for coming. I think when we talk about mental health issues, we often forget about the impact on family members, and especially for siblings that are growing up in families with siblings that have mental health issues or disabilities who are sharing their parents and often sacrificing their own needs and then grow up to be wonderful advocates for their siblings and other people. So I know that you've experienced a lot more than I have in a lifetime, and I'm just very grateful that you've come today to share your story, and I know that you'll continue doing that and making a difference for your brother and for other siblings of people as well. So thank you very much for coming today.
Representative Greenlink.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Mr. Connor, I'd like you to consider with us for a moment. I have severe mental illness in my family and in several of my very closest friends who have similar problems to what you've been dealing with over these years. In three sessions in the legislature now, we've heard testimony after testimony about how screwed up the mental health system is in a variety of ways. So you're just confirming for us what we continue to hear and what we desperately want to try to figure out how to do something about. Can you imagine if this particular bill had passed 10 years ago, your family's experience would have been different? And how would you imagine it would have been different? Excuse me.
I believe that the medications that Chris has been taking would not have been altered as many times as they have. The closest thing to a cure or to solving a mental order or a mental disorder I'm learning quickly is through balancing out. You're trying to balance out the chemicals in someone's brain and trying to, I guess you could say, in essence, play God with that person and trying to just balance them out. Chris and our family, through all these different appointments, has been balanced off and on of so many different medications because he's had one psychiatrist come in, recommend one prescription. 6 months later, we have a new psychiatrist who says that's not working, so we're going to do something else. And it's this up and down effect. If he would have had a psychologist 10, 11 years ago, I can't say what the outcome would have been because that would have been 10 years ago. But the likelihood of him having one psychologist, not 20 psychiatrists, could play the effect of he would have a set person, a set prescription to balance him out on.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
That's very perceptive.
Representative Brewer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Grover, I want to follow with you with some of the testimony that Mr. Connor gave, and it was alluded to earlier, but it's this 15-minute thing, and I raise that. He said it today. I've also had in prior correspondence on this particular bill prior to today, have had the same 15 minutes mentioned to me on at least two or three emails. And my question to you is, I'm sure, you know, I will ask a psychiatrist as well, but what drives that? What is the driving difference that gives a psychiatrist a 15-minute appointment once every 3 or 4 months versus a psychologist who can have, a longer appointment once a week or once a month? Is it purely a capacity issue, or do we have so few psychiatrists that that's the only way we can do it? Is it a reimbursement issue? Is it a Medicaid, Medicare reimbursement sort of issue, and that's what works within the various, you know, schematic? Or is it just a different way that the practices practice? Psychologists do it one way, and psychiatrists do it a different way.
I think the answer to all good multi-part questions is yes. All of the things that you've mentioned are factors that play into that.
Okay.
One, that's part of the way that psychiatrists practice. There are psychiatrists, by the way, who do psychotherapy and do meet with patients for an hour and include the psychopharmacology in that. However, a majority of psychiatrists tend to focus, and again, I also asked the psychiatrist who'll be talking today, and this is my perspective from working in partnership with them, but they tend to focus. Some psychiatrists focus specifically on the psychopharmacology, and they're focusing on the medication, its effects, its side effects, is it working, is it not working, is the person tolerating it, are they responding to it? And they focus on those elements in their visit, and then enough information that they need to know around that to safely and effectively prescribe in that area. The most psychologists tend to want to have a psychotherapeutic relationship with someone that involves getting to know them, understanding where they're coming from, and talking with them over time. That's part of the key parts of our training is learning how to engage people in that process. So we want to include a comprehensive treatment where we engage them in that process and are able to manage the pharmacology component of their treatment as well.
I just want to jump in. There is a workforce shortage in physicians. Primary care is already at 20%. Psychiatry is about 23%. That is in the U.S. statistics of the Bureau of Labor. And the projection to 2020 is those will continue to increase. So there is a great deal of pressure in terms of providing service with a workplace shortage of physicians, which I think is true in every level of care, and it is a concern of health care throughout the country.
Madam Chair, if I can follow. I heard you say, you know, to my sort of question, it's sort of a little bit of all that. Are you saying that it is the capacity issue that's the overriding issue, in your opinion?
I think that pressures people into having to provide more services to more people.
More than a reimbursement situation or anything else.
Okay. I think that's what I have seen.
Just to simply illustrate that, when I talk about that case example of a hospital discharge patient, a typical psychiatrist has a waiting list for people to come into their practice of weeks at least. So there is that, I think, pressure to see as many people as possible and to deliver that valuable service in as efficient a way as possible.
Thank you.
It is a very valuable service. It's desperately needed.
Other questions? I have one final one. My impression is that you yourself could take advantage of this because you have the additional education, Dr. Lindsay. But not every psychologist is running out wanting to do that. Could you speak to that, just why that is and why there might be a limited take-up if we pass something like this?
This is a subspecialty. I've already invested $15,000 in this education because I believe in it. It is something we pay for ourselves. There is no subsidy to it. And I think that is a self-limiting factor. There are no grants or loans for this type of program for us at this point. So I think that, but it also is, psychology is a diverse profession. People will have different kinds of specialties, and we need to maintain that, just as medicine has different specialties. So this will be specialty, and sometimes it is driven by the need within the community in which we practice. Right now, there is a small group of us who have done this without even knowing whether we'll ever be able to prescribe. We did it because we believe that the education was essential to the kind of care that we provide. But it is something that a person would have to go to school for an extra 2 or 3 years. And once you've already gone for, you know, 8 or 9 or 10, it gets to be a bit much.
Thank you. Well, we appreciate Jessamine. Thank you very much for being here. And we're going to move on to the next panel. I just want to note for the record, and we will get a copy of the PowerPoint.
Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That we have written testimony from Becky Child, president of the Mental Health Association of Oregon, that we're putting into the record that was, I think, at our desk. Now, the next panel we have is Dr. Lay still here? How about Dr. Winters? And then okay. Mr. McCulley? So it's come to my attention that there's a Dr. Connett Norville who perhaps would not be able to come back for an addition.
You can't come up here. I just want to say speaking to Dr. Liz.
Okay.
Am I speaking?
I hear that because of your schedule, Dr. Connett Norville, that you're not able maybe to come back if we have to continue testimony for another day. So I want to make sure that we have you come up next. So just giving you some advance warning. So, Mr. McCulley?
And then is Dr. Winters?
Dr. Here? Winters?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm John McCulley, Oregon Psychiatric Association. I can come back, but there are others here who would have more difficulty than I would. So if Dr. Winters, Dr. Norwood Knight Richardson, Dr. Conan Norville could testify instead of me, that would be wonderful.
Well,
and Dr.
Powell
could represent Dr. Lace or the Oregon Medical Association.
All right, so Dr.
Powell. She's here for Dr. Lace.
For Dr. Lace, thank you.
So Dr. Winters needs to come up.
Dr. Winters still here?
Yeah.
Thank you. And then Dr. Knight Richardson? Thank you. Sorry for the confusion. There's way too many doctors on my list.
You could be glad they're not lawyers.
Think of all those people that aren't getting sure. A 15-minute appointment today.
So thank you for being here. Is there anyone else that has traveled any great distance?
This gentleman is.
I didn't throw out the official form.
This gentleman's from Hermiston, I believe.
Dr. Marlowe?
Yeah.
Thank you.
And I don't know who the other one is. But we can get to that.
Okay.
Later.
We'll make sure the travelers can get up next. So thank you. Please, go right ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Constance Powell, and I'm speaking on behalf of the Oregon Medical Association. I'm a past president of that organization and a practicing psychiatrist. In the interest of full disclosure, after earning a bachelor's in liberal arts with minimal science class exposure, I then started a master's in psychology, which is a social science. And after completing the coursework, I switched to a pre-med program. I was very interested in psychology, I still am, but concluded that it was a study of part of the person, and we all have an experience which is addressed by the study of psychology, and we all have a biology, and the best evaluation of what a person could best benefit from would be the study of both of those things, since they intersect in such complex ways in, for all of us. I think what I'll do is you ask some questions. What is what do we do anyway? I'm hearing that question. How long do we see people? What do I do anyway? I am trained to evaluate an individual, trying to determine which organ system the complaints are coming from. Because there are a lot of disease. Saying depression is a little bit like saying fever. It tells you what the symptom is, but it doesn't tell you how you got there. It doesn't tell you if it's a vitamin deficiency. It doesn't tell you if it's a thyroid problem. It doesn't tell you anything about how the person got to depression. It just is their presenting complaint. So you listen to what the complaint is and then try to think about what it is you need to rule out to think it was a brain disorder. then there is, you get to the part of a brain disorder, which part of it is biological and which part of it is just a bad experience or a response to environmental events. So that's another set of determinations that medical training enables you to do. So once given the individual and that it isn't some other organ system, if there are a lot of them in there, they're all related in very complex ways that we don't really fully understand, have a few clues about. But then, what is the best treatment for that person if it is a mental disorder? And it isn't always medication, and it isn't always therapy. And sometimes it's a little of both, and sometimes a little of this or another. And that's my job, is to make my best guess about what that's a case of, and then do a treatment program. Now, there aren't enough doctors, there aren't enough nurse practitioners, there aren't enough nurses, but definitely the medical training line best suits one to address that kind of complex tangle. Train more nurses. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Powell. And the position of the OMA?
I'm sorry, very much oppose this bill, strongly oppose.
Thank you very much. Dr. Winters.
I believe that if it's acceptable to you, that Dr. Knight Richardson
that's
will
totally fine. Dr. Knight Richardson?
Madam
yes?
Chair,
okay,
honorable members of the committee, thank you for allowing us to be here today. I am Norwood Knight Richardson, Vice Chair of Psychiatry for Oregon Health and Sciences University, Director of the Division of Public Psychiatry, and Founder and Director of the Telepsychiatry Program at OHSU. There's incontrovertible evidence that psychologists' geographical practice patterns are no different than other highly trained professionals. They tend to cluster around urban areas. Therefore, the argument that granting prescriptive privileges to psychologists answers the need for improved access to mental health care and addresses the shortage of prescribing physicians is specious and serves only to distract from the real issue. The real issue in this and all of the other states of these United States is access to high quality, appropriate, and effective mental health care. Mental disorders or brain disorders caused by biochemical, structural, or physiological aberrancies, the underlying causes of which can vary from traumatic injury to genetic coding, and the symptoms of which are influenced by the psychosocial environment of the individual. These illnesses are often accompanied by comorbid somatic illnesses such as diabetes, hypertension, chronic gastrointestinal disorders, which affect absorption of medications, respiratory disorders, inborn orders of metabolism, endocrine disorders, and neurological disorders, amongst a vast array of others. The presence of these disorders significantly influences the efficacy of a chosen psychotropic medication and the side effects of that medication, some of which can be lethal. To skillfully prescribe psychotropic medications and do no harm, a credo of medicine, requires knowledge of general medicine and medical treatments for the many medical illnesses which can be comorbid with mental illnesses. That is why psychiatrists are trained for 5 years in general medicine and neurology and spend a total of 8 to 9 years in postgraduate training. Not a course. These are years. To believe a non-medical professional can be adequately trained to expertly administer medication by taking courses in psychopharmacology is to greatly trivialize the complexity of mental disorders, which, in my opinion, is a moral outrage and leads us back to the days when our abysmal ignorance induced us to believe mental illnesses were an infection of the soul. If we truly believe high quality of care is not an issue here and these illnesses are simple to treat, then let us allow elementary school teachers to diagnose and treat attention deficit hyperactivity disorder by giving them a course or two. Or We should allow master's level psychologists and social workers to take the same training as proposed in HB 2800 and prescribe. Or we should just make all psychotropic medications available over the counter. As you should be able to see, this is a very slippery slope. Let me propose another solution to our access problem that ensures we maintain quality of treatment and optimal clinical outcomes. Number one, train more psychiatrists. Our university has stepped up to the plate in this a proposal to the governor, to the Senate, and to the House that we are capable, we have the capacity to, if supported, train more psychiatrists. We need to train more nurse practitioners. The university has the capacity to train more nurse practitioners. We need to train more physician assistants. We need to provide expert consultative support to primary care physicians, in fact, who are writing more prescriptions for psychotropic medications than psychiatrists are. We need to support the use of telemedicine to extend access to competent clinicians for underserved areas. And this last point addresses the previous point about family health care practitioners. With support from the community and the administration, I founded the first telemedicine studio at Oregon Health and Sciences University. Dr. Winters will talk to you more about that in detail and how it applies to children, but we currently see adults throughout the state through telemedicine. Studies beginning in the 1950s, when telemedicine was first tried using television cameras, right until now, and including the expertise of the U.S. military, surveys, and these are not, we don't have adequate studies, and I sit on the board of the National Institutes of Mental Health, and we're promoting those studies, have shown that customers, the patient, is generally satisfied to the extent of approximately 98%. Physicians' satisfaction ranged from 95% to 100%, and the biggest complaint was, well, we sort of miss seeing each other face-to-face. Accuracy of diagnosis was 100%. So it is possible to make accurate diagnosis through this modality. And as Dr. Winters will point out, that it is particularly suitable to children. Dr. Bates and I have spent a lot of hours talking about the use of telemedicine, Dr. Senator Bates. And for his purposes, consultative availability of psychiatrists through the telehealth program, which is fairly cheap, about $6,000 to $7,000 for a setup, and we can access through T1 lines, or we can access over the Internet, or we can access over optic fiber. If he has a patient in his office that he needs a consultation on, we simply move them to next door, and we can put him on camera for a scheduled visit. And again, if you go back to the data, it's just as accurate and effective. In fact, before I came here this morning, I was seeing patients in Louisiana. These are still victims of the hurricane that I see and follow up with and treat psychopharmacologically, and they are very satisfied with the treatment. So, in my heart, I believe you will make the wise decision for the health and safety of the citizens of this state and not approve this misguided HB 2800. We, the people, deserve to be treated with a higher quality of care than what this bill proposes. I respectfully submit these comments to you.
Thank you, Doctor.
Can
we hear from Dr. Winters briefly? And I only say briefly because there are some folks I want to make sure we get in today. So we'll touch on some of the telemedicine
already.
Right. Dr. Winters.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to give testimony to the chairwoman and members of the committee. Dr. Nancy Winters, I'm a general and child psychiatrist. I practice at OHSU, where I direct the child psychiatry residency, and I teach in both adult and child psychiatry. And I'd like you to know, on the previous comment about psychiatrists doing psychotherapy, that I am a psychotherapy teacher, and we have psychotherapy training throughout our residency, which means 4 full years of psychotherapy training for adult psychiatrists and 6 for child psychiatrists. Also, looking around the room at my psychiatric colleagues, most of whom I know, and I know them all to be people that do psychotherapy. So I really think that some of the comments about the differences between psychiatrists and psychologists are very much more individual-oriented, and I'm not sure that those represent truth about the groups. I do also think that if small numbers of psychologists become prescribers, they will get very busy, too, and they will have lots of phone calls, probably a waiting list, and that is the reality of the need. I think we all do agree that there is a vast under-resource in mental health. There's no dispute about that. What I wanted to do today is tell you a little bit about what we're trying to do in the interest of addressing the rural shortage of prescribing physicians. And we've developed under the telehealth division that Dr. Knight Richardson leads. We've developed a pediatric telepsychiatry program. I also, on the other side, I thought you would be interested in an article on a Texas program that is doing telepsychiatry in high schools and talks about the high level of satisfaction among the students. As Dr. Knight Richardson alluded to, children really do like technology. So it works quite well. So I don't want to belabor the technology, but it's basically a video conferencing system in which doctors can meet with patients in remote locations. Before I drove down here today, I was seeing patients in Baker City, Oregon. And I've traveled to do on-site work in Baker City as well as Pendleton and many other rural counties. And I can tell you that it works much better to do it by telepsychiatry because it takes at least a day to get to Baker City. So we, through telepsychiatry, can perform the full array of diagnosis and treatment services. I've just done a very extensive literature review on this as part of a grant that I submitted to the National Institutes of Health. And I can tell you that there is now a substantial evidence base that telepsychiatry works and several very good studies showing that the outcomes are equal. So it's very encouraging. What we're doing at OHSU is that as of 2 years ago, when I was approached by another child psychiatrist who was working with the Greater Oregon Behavioral Health Incorporated Network, which is a large mental health community network, serves 12 rural counties in Oregon, including Burns, Harney, Clatsop, Umatilla, Baker. I'm not going to be able to name all of them, but it doesn't include the county that Hood River is in, interestingly. I think it's Hood River County. So they needed more child psychiatry time, so I was very stimulated to get this going, and we have built a team over the past 2 years. We have two faculty child psychiatrists, and we're involving three senior child psychiatry residents who are in their fifth year of training post-medical school. We have a team that serves the whole Gobi region, so any of those 12 counties can consult us. And we see very, very complicated cases, including cases that are very medically complicated and cases that primary care physicians are stumped by. For an example, we had a young mentally retarded, a young man of 17 who had a very severe reaction to a medication that was working for him. He dropped his platelets down to a very dangerous level. And we were asked by the primary care physician to sort out his many medical and also endocrinologic issues. He also had problems with his blood sugar. So that took about 3 weeks, and we were able to get that sorted out. We've been keeping a database since July 1st. And since July 1st, we've seen about 100 children in these rural counties, and the satisfaction with our services is very high. I'd also like to let you know that there are three other child psychiatrists who are doing telepsychiatry from their private office. So this is also a technology that private practitioners can use. There are a number of others that have expressed interest to me in joining that and doing this work.
Dr. Rogers, you want me to wrap up? That'd be great.
I just want to mention the, I think that really the great potential of this technology is saving travel time. Also saves a lot of money because travel time doesn't have to get paid for and patients do not have to travel. The other thing that's very helpful, I think Dr. Knight Richardson alluded to it, is scheduling. It's a lot easier to schedule someone as frequently as they need to if you just have to walk into a video conferencing suite. There are some startup costs, but I think if you look at the potential cost saving in all the travel time, the burden to patients to travel to get the most skilled consultation, I think you'll see that it can be very, very helpful.
Thank you, Dr. Winters. I appreciate that, and I appreciate the overview on telemedicine. It's very helpful. Representative Greenlee?
Yeah, I had a simple question. Dr. Knight Richardson, this is on OHSU stationery. Is it safe to assume that your position is the official position of OHSU?
I think that is safe to assume.
We can check that with the lobbyists and see if they want to come and confirm it. Is it also, you note yourself as a trustee of the OHSU Foundation. Is this the official position of the OHSU Foundation?
I have no opinion on that. I do not know.
Representative Flores?
Thank you, and doctors, thank you for the interesting testimony regarding telemedicine and telepsychiatry and the efficacy of this technological enhancement. Do you support the also tele-education or tele-learning processes that are available in the context of the scope of this bill?
Yes, I do, Representative Flores. In fact, in our contract with most of the organizations that we provide this service to is a provision that we are available to do in-service to other clinicians or to staff.
Thank you.
Certainly.
I have a question for Dr. Knight Richardson. The part of 2800 talks about collaboration with the primary care physician. I understand your concerns around the medical conditions. Is your perspective that that's not adequate in terms of psychologists working with the primary care physician in terms of the medical needs of the person that they might prescribe to?
I think you're exactly right, Madam Chair, that I don't think that is adequate. I am humbled by the complexity of and the challenge of mental illness and the human body. I cannot imagine, and I came to medicine after being a banker, and let me tell you, I could not have imagined not going through medical school trying to correctly prescribe and correctly protect the health of my patients without having had and acquired that knowledge. And I've been practicing now almost 20 years, and I am still humbled by that complexity. The interrelationship of general somatic illnesses and these neurologically brain-based disorders we call mental illness is very, very complex. I wish what they are presenting and want to happen in this bill were true, but in my heart, I know it cannot be. You simply cannot be prepared for this with a master's level course. You simply cannot be. If you have not been at the bedside, if you haven't treated these other illnesses, I simply cannot imagine it. And that's just sincere as I can be. I wish I could, but I can't.
Thank you, Doctor. Representative Brune?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Doctors. I very much appreciate the testimony specifically regarding the telepsychiatry, and I think that's a wonderful new phenomenon. I think it rolls into the telemedicine, which Representative Greenlee has talked about. I think it's a wonderful phenomenon. My question is, especially based on the earlier testimony from Mr. Connor, my question would be this. Assuming that we can, as a state, get our arms around the capacity issues, if you will, the access, that's probably better said, the access issues, either more psychiatrists or making sure that our psychiatrists in Portland metropolitan area have a way to, you know, to talk to the people in Burns and LeGrand and everything else. Assuming we can handle that some way, I would ask the follow-up question of that, are we covering all the gaps in mental health care? And what I mean by that specifically is goes back to Mr. Connor's testimony, which is, apparently his brother had access to a psychiatrist, but something was wrong there. And I'm sure that his case isn't, I hope it's not I hope it's not widespread, but I don't think it's absolutely unique either. That would be the best way to say that. So I would just throw out, and I know we don't have a lot of time, but is there a legitimate gap that somehow, you know, this legislature should get our arms around to deal with?
Can I? I'm sure we all have something to say about this. I think there are many gaps. I think that probably the biggest thing that was driven home by that story to me is the complexity of severe mental illness and the fact that this individual was very ill. And my suspicion is that many medicines were tried because they didn't work very well. And I don't think that given the reality of severe mental illness, which doesn't always get magically cured by even the best medications, I don't think that any of us are on solid ground, really, to present ourselves as having some other magic that nobody else has. Because these are tough, and that's why we keep changing. I think the other thing is the 15-minute med check. I don't know whether it was going on in a community mental health center or not. It may have been. If it was, one of the reasons why they don't have more time than that is because the budgets of these organizations are so tight, they can't afford to let psychiatrists see patients for longer than that. So it's not that we're not willing to, it's just that those budgets are very, very, very tight. And that is a larger funding issue.
Thank you. Quickly, Doug.
And just continuing on that through a few more levels of gaps, which are numerous. The medical piece is just one piece of a person's life, and there are many other services and types of support and expertise that any person with severe mental illness needs, and our mental health system is seriously underfunded.
Thank you, and thank you all for being here, and thank you for your testimony. I'd like to call up Robin Henderson, David Wade, and Douglas Marlowe, please. And then on deck we have so Dr. Keepers, Dr. Conant-Norvo, and Dr. Gluckman, next up, okay? Are you doing a PowerPoint?
It's a brief one, yes.
It's a brief one?
I don't know where they came over. Yeah, they asked. Oh, the group. The people here.
Well, we're They're checking on the room first.
We're checking.
Dr. Wade, would you like to start?
All right.
In the interest of time.
Okay. Well, thank you. Madam Chair and the rest of the committee, I appreciate this opportunity to talk about my support for House Bill 2800. My name is David Wade. I'm a clinical psychologist working in Hood River, Oregon, and I've been involved in mental health since 1979. I went back and completed my doctorate in psychology in 92. And to tell you the truth, I had not planned to go back to school. But having worked with a number of patients over the years and seen the difficulty in getting into a psychiatrist, it's not uncommon to have a three-month wait. Trying to work with primary care physicians who are struggling with dealing with psychotropic medications, I felt like I needed to go back and get some training and get this postdoctoral master's in clinical psychopharmacology, even if I never prescribe. I hope to someday, though, prescribe. I've heard some passionate views on both sides of the coin here, and I think that there's some things we can agree on. I think we can agree on there's a major problem with our health system, mental health, and a deficit of psychiatric care. I think we can also agree that we want the best possible care for Oregonians, and this means safe care. I would also say that psychiatrists, compared to prescribing psychologists, psychiatrists are better trained to prescribe psychotropic medications. I don't think that there's any, in my mind, there's no question with that. However, I'd like to keep in mind what we're talking about here is not trying to replace psychiatrists. If we had enough psychiatrists, I wouldn't be here. We're trying to figure out how to help the primary care practitioner. These are nurse practitioners, physician assistants, and MDs, all of these folks that are trying, and they prescribe 70 to 75% of the psychotropic medications in Oregon. those are the folks that we're trying to help. Now, if I want to compare my training to a primary care practitioner, am I better trained to assess mental illness? You bet I am. And to treat with therapy? Yes. Okay. Now, in the interest of time, I am going to skip over some things, but I did a little searching in terms of time here, and as a psychologist, I have some benefits, I guess, over a primary care practitioner. I typically see patients 50 to 60 minutes every week. I did a little research, and there's a and this is from a government study, the National Center for Health Statistics and National Ambulatory Medical Care Survey. In 2000, they looked at the average of time a primary care practitioner spends with their patient. It was 18.1 minutes. Okay, now in that amount of time, they're supposed to check out pulmonary functioning, renal functioning, dermatology problems. Maybe there's a strained ankle. There are a whole bunch of issues they're trying to cram into one piece. How can they do that? I don't think that they can very well. And I think they're doing their best, but by default, it falls back to the primary care practitioner because we don't have enough people who can prescribe medications. I think that it's important to also keep in mind talking about prescribing medications also means being able to take people off medications. I treat a lot of anxiety disorders. Sometimes I have people come through that are on a benzodiazepine, which is a minor tranquilizer. Well, I know in terms of using cognitive behavioral therapy, this is actually going to get in the way of my treatment. And to be able to take people off medications could be very, very helpful at times, of course, in consultation with the person who's prescribing. I've had lots of experiences. I do a lot of work with children. I've had children come see me who are on stimulant medications who have not had an adequate diagnosis, and they don't have attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and they don't need to be on the stimulant. Now, that's not always the case. Likewise, I've had kids on stimulant medication maybe for 7 or 8 years, and they come into my office, and I say, so how's the medicine going? They say, well, I don't know. And the parents say, I don't know. How long have you been on it? 7, 8 years. Has it been adjusted? No. Have you ever been taken off it to see if you still need to be on it? No. Okay, now, when I talk about these situations, again, I don't want to talk ill of the primary care providers because I think they're doing the best job that they can. And I think that they're overwhelmed and overworked. And as a psychologist with the proper training, we have the ability to help them out. We use what's called a biopsychosocial model, so it's different than typical medicine. If somebody walks through my door, I don't automatically think, let's get them on medicine. I think, okay, let's take a look at medicine as one tool out of many. And if I can treat somebody without medication, you bet I'm going to do that. However, sometimes we need to treat people with medication.
Dr. Wade, I'm going to ask you to wrap up.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, can I? All right. So, this is the third time we've been here suggesting a prescription privilege bill. Each time the Oregon Psychiatric Association and the Oregon Medical Association have said, this is a bad idea, it's going to be bad for people, it's going to be dangerous, and they said it's not adequate training. Well, in Louisiana, a state that has prescribing psychologists, they are prescribing under similar guidelines as to the initial bill, and they've written tens of thousands of prescriptions without incident. However, we went back to the drawing board. House Bill 2800 is more robust in that we have additional hours of training, and we require the postdoctoral master's in clinical psychopharmacology or the Department of Defense training. We put in there a year supervised training underneath a medical profession who knows about psychotropic medications. I think that was a great idea. And we also require the psychologist, the prescribing psychologist, to network with the primary care practitioner. So that what that means is somebody comes into my door and they don't have a primary care practitioner, I can't prescribe for them because I need to be networking with another medical professional. So anyhow, I will wrap it up, and I think that this is a good idea. I think that we put a lot of thought into this, and I think that both sides want the same thing. We want safe care for Oregonians, and so you folks have the ability to make this bill happen, and I respectfully request that you support House Bill 2800. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Wade. I just want to let folks know we're going to go till 5:30. We're not going to get through everyone, but I'd like to at least get through this panel and the remaining three folks. And I apologize for those who have waited. We're going to lose some of our committee here, but we will only go to 5:30. So
I will keep it brief.
Here you go.
I can get through a PowerPoint really quick.
Okay.
My name is Dr. Robin Anderson. I'm a licensed clinical psychologist. I'm director of behavioral health services at St. Charles Medical Center in Bend, Oregon. And tell me if I talk too fast, because I can slow down. Thank you very much. I am a native Oregonian. I have spent 25 years of my life working in healthcare settings and mental health. I've been a residential inpatient. I was at the Oregon State Hospital for a while on the now defunct SCAT unit back when I was an intern as an undergraduate. So I've worked in mental health for a long time, and I've spent a lot of time with psychiatry. This is not an issue between psychiatry and psychology. It's not. Many of the folks here testifying today and who are in the room are my friends. They're my colleagues. They're people I have known and respected for years. And bar none, they are the experts in prescribing psychotropic medications. And the reality is, they're only prescribing 15 to 25% of them. In my area, psychiatrists only get to prescribe, psychiatrists and nurse practitioners, thank you, psychiatrists, nurse practitioners, and PAs only prescribe 15%. 85% is done by the primary care physicians. And that's really what I want to talk with you about today. I am a huge supporter of telehealth. You can ask Dr. Knight Richardson. I wrote a grant that, you know, got $500,000 from the Rural Utility Services District and put video conferencing equipment in 18 rural mental health clinics so that his practitioners could talk to these folks and do this kind of work. I'm the one who wrote that grant. I'm a huge supporter. I think it's great. I don't think it's the full solution to the problem, because what we're talking about are the issues with primary care. My main concern and interest is really that, and that's what brings me here today. And one of the things, the points that Mr. Connor didn't get to share with you today, was that his brother Chris has multiple medical issues, and he has a primary care physician. And his primary care physician is afraid of him. And that's a common occurrence that I see. When I first got to Bend many, many years ago, 5 years ago, the family practice docs and primary care docs looked at me and said, "Great, you're here. I don't want to see them anymore." Them who? Them, those people, the ones with mental illness. I don't want to see them. I had a horrific medical staff battle that I won't even tell you about when I got my first psychiatrist who finally agreed to come there. Bless his heart. I will worship the ground he walks on for the rest of his life, I'm sure. But that medical staff looked at him and said, "Okay, we have a psychiatrist now. You get every bit of the mental health issues in our hospital." And as I'll talk to you a little bit later, they're not just in the psychiatric unit. Behavioral health disorders are common. You can see from this slide, 46% of us are going to have some type of diagnosable disorder at some point in our lives. That's a pretty big idea. Not everybody's going to need medication. Not everybody's going to need therapy. A lot of times it's just like the common cold. That's what we call dysthymia, the common cold of mental illness. And when 75 to 85% of all psychotropic prescriptions are written by primary care, most of these folks are uncomfortable with that. They don't want to be writing the prescriptions. They don't understand all the medications. They have to know thousands upon thousands of medications for everything from cardiac conditions to you name it. Psychotropics is a whole other science in and of itself. And few of these folks, if any, have specific training in the Diagnostic and Systems Manual, what we use for diagnosis, that psychiatrists, psychologists, and psychiatric nurse practitioners are well-versed in. I want to just give you some slides for reference you can look at later that talk about the workforce profile in Oregon and the lack of primary care physicians in Oregon, and also a little bit of stuff about our physician workforce studies right here. I won't belabor that. You can look at that on your own time. I was recently at a conference back in D.C. that talked about the fact that psychiatry is the least chosen profession for students coming out of medical schools. We have to figure out how to solve that. I think we really need to figure out how to solve that. But we also need to figure out how to solve our access problem. Because even if we change today, how are we going to catch up? Take a look at the gap. Right there, the blue line is the active psychiatrist in clinical practice. And the pink line represents the average need. That's not the baseline. That's not the high need. That's the average need of what we're going to need. And in Oregon, it's even worse. According to the BME, Oregon currently has 64 child psychiatrists, 519 psychiatrists, and 15 psychiatry and neurology licensed folks. But the Board of Medical Examiners states that these numbers are active licenses and don't reflect the working physicians. And this could lead to a significant overestimation of the number of, you know, the potential man-woman power in this state. The Office of Rural Health estimates that a community should have one psychiatrist for about every 6,000 physicians, citizens. And I want to take a second here to talk about the fact that when we were talking about the 15-minute issue, I'll tell you a brief story. I recruit psychiatrists. It's part of what I do in my role at the hospital. So I've interviewed tons of them. And I tell you, I will not hire anyone who does 10-minute medication visits. There are psychiatrists who came in and looked at me and said, my practice, I see 5 patients an hour. Bing, bang, bing, bang, boom. And that's great because that helps me keep my income up. And I looked at him and thought, wow, I get to spend the rest of the day with you, take you to a very nice dinner, put you on a plane and send you home, and never call you again because I will not hire that. That is an anomaly in psychiatry. But that is part of what some people's belief systems are. Now, psychologists, through their training, have the skills to build relationships with clients, families, and the community providers. They can assess mental health issues, and they can accurately diagnose mental health issues, which is the number one key issue we have to deal with. Accurate diagnosis. We get an accurate diagnosis, then we can formulate a treatment plan that may or may not include medication. That's what psychologists can do right now. Prescribing psychologists, and I am not one of them, I am not trained, I have not taken the medical psychology degree, but I do see the value of it for my profession. They do all of those things, and they're trained to medically assess the patient, collaborate with primary care, and that's incredibly important. These are people who pick up the phone. Even when they're not medically trained, they pick up the phone and they talk with people. That's the nature of our training. We want more information. We're high need for information people, and that's our style of practice. We prescribe when needed, unprescribe when not, and most importantly, monitor and evaluate progress in conjunction with ongoing therapy, which means it's happening on a very frequent basis and not once every 3 to 4 months, which is what is currently common. We have a workforce shortage in Oregon. We've talked about it. The master plan calls for more psychiatrists. How are we going to fill that? The community system of care plan, which I'm sure many of you have seen, the input of that is staggered so that we're only looking at a 25% impact each biennium. Why? Workforce issues. Hospitals statewide are struggling to find psychiatrists willing to take call, cover inpatient units, and do consults in the hospital, where an estimated 60%, and this is a stat that just came out of the American Hospital Association, 60% of all patients at any given time on any floor in a hospital, any floor, have a secondary or tertiary mental health diagnosis, and that's what drives up health care costs. We have to find a way to impact this. We're just part of the solution. We're not the total solution. We're just part of the solution. Like I said, this isn't about psychiatry and psychology. This is about adding providers to support the primary care system we have and getting accurate diagnosis and treatment for the mentally ill in Oregon. Thank you very much for your time and attention.
Thank you very much, Dr. Anderson. And that was quick, Dr. Marlowe.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thanks for having me here. My name is Doug Marlowe. I'm a clinical psychologist in Hermiston, Oregon. I opened my practice about 4.5 years ago after coming from the Navy, where I was 6.5 years there, doing inpatient, outpatient psychotherapy. In the Navy's program. There's so much. It's hard to know where to start. I think I want to start and speak for someone who can't be here today. One of my mentors at Navy was Captain Morgan Sammons. He was trained in the Department of Defense program, and he wanted to be here today, but he's been in Iraq for the last 7 months. And so he wrote me an email I'd like to read to you. Best of luck at your hearing. I'm roomed at Al Takadum for a while. I can't tell you exactly when I'll be back. It will be sometime around the time of your hearing, but too late to make it. You may say, if you wish, on my behalf that while, quote, I'm just returning from Iraq and cannot attend the hearing, I also speak as a private citizen and not in my capacity as specialty leader for Navy clinical psychology. As a prescribing psychologist about to return from a 7-month deployment in Iraq, I see the acquisition of prescriptive authority as a vital skill for psychologists. The ability to use psychotropic medication while treating our troops for PTSD and similar disorders was a tremendous boon to me and my patients during this deployment. In the coming months and years, we'll be faced with large numbers of service members who may seek help from some of the psychological after effects of combat. The demands placed by these service members may strain current mental health services. Some of these veterans may require medication in addition to the psychotherapy that is the mainstay for most combat stress conditions. The ability of a well-trained psychotherapist to provide appropriate and targeted pharmacotherapy will be of material assistance to these veterans as well as to members of the public at large. And Captain Morgan Sammons, when he retires, I think in 2.5 or 3 years from the Navy, has property in Ashland, plans to come and live there. I'm not RXP trained either. He is the reason that I believe in this, and I want him to be able to practice fully for his full capability. In the Navy, we have the term tip of the spear. I'm the very first psychologist that's ever been in Hermiston, Oregon. The need was so great that I invited another psychologist to come work with me. My average wait time for a new eval is about 2 months, sometimes more, sometimes a little less. I don't have training in children. Specifically, I was trained across the lifespan in graduate school, but my training was in the Navy for internship and then after internship. My practice consists of 25 to 40% of my patients seeing children on any given day or week. Madam Chair, Representative Flores, you wondered about the need of the access care issue and the quality of care issue. And in many ways, I wish I wasn't here today, because I wish who stayed in my place was my clients. Because I have an influential relationship, I can't suggest that they come here. That's not ethical. But mental health is something that affects all of us. This is one degree of separation, not six. Everyone in this room knows someone who struggles with stress or alcohol or depression or anxiety or some mental health challenge. And I would encourage you to remember the people side of this. We have a billboard in Umatilla County that says, the top of the billboard is 555. Those are the number of suicides in Oregon in 2005, I believe. It may be 2004, but I think that's right. Number of murders, 119. Number of DUIs, 212. This has a human face. People are hurting because they can't have access. As Representative Brun said, there are holes in our system that aren't being filled. And I agree with Robin and others that say this isn't the total solution, but it is one solution. I want to say one quick thing about telemedicine. I'm a member of the Oregon Psychological Association, and we may very well support the telemedicine concept, but it doesn't add more providers. It distributes care. I'm in Umatilla County, 70,000 people, not one psychiatrist. We've had a psychiatrist. He retired. We have, I believe, two psychiatric nurse practitioners. As Dr. Knight Richardson said, this is an access issue and a quality of care issue. Every doctor knows that there's some people we refer to, some people we don't refer to. And there's many reasons for that. Sometimes it's quality, but if you're in Umatilla County, don't be elderly, because the psychiatric nurse practitioner that I refer to doesn't take Social Security or the SSI disability. Medicare. That's difficult. That's really difficult. I had to send a patient of mine back up to Yakima because his primary care provider was a nurse practitioner, and he had been psychotic about 5 years ago and admitted into a hospital there, and she wasn't comfortable continuing to manage his psychiatric medications. So please remember the human face to this that I see every day, and I wish you could hear the stories of that my clients tell me when they're trying to get help for the struggles that they have. And, Madam Chair, to answer one of Representative Gelder's questions, I always include the family, if the client will let me, with children. I ask for their assent. I always bring mom and dad. I tell mom and dad when I'm setting up a new appointment, please come to that session. Sometimes only one parent can come. But I always include them, and frequently during the therapy sessions, especially with kids, because mom and dad see them every day and have the biggest impact on them, not me for 1 hour a week. So this is a different model of care that I think is critical. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you, Dr. Marlowe. And I just want to thank you all for making the trip this far. And we have several other folks who can't come back, so I want to give them the last 15 minutes. But any quick questions for this panel? Committee members? And I just want to assure everyone, this panel and everyone else, that, and I hate to rush anyone, but if you have written testimony, we will read it. So I appreciate the summaries that you've done and how quickly you've done it. So thank you very much for being here.
Thank you,
so I want to close up with Dr. Keepers, Dr. Conant Norville, and Dr. Gluckman. And then if there are folks who I haven't called on, and I think there are a couple.
Let me start with this.
Yes. Okay. We will have additional testimony on House Bill 2800 on Thursday. So if you can come back, if you could let the committee assistant know, that would be helpful. So thank you. Thank you all for your patience. Whoever wants to go first.
I guess I will. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you on behalf of OHSU.
I'm Dr. George Keepers. I'm the chair of the Department of Psychiatry, a department which includes the clinical division of psychology at OHSU. It's been a pleasure to listen to my colleagues in psychiatry and in psychology today. I think that from the testimony that you've heard, you can tell that we agree on many aspects of the problems with mental health access to care and delivery here in Oregon. And I think you can also tell how much the safe and appropriate care of people with mental health problems matters to all of us. I'm going to limit my comments to things that other folks have not talked about to any great extent, and try and make a contribution to the testimony in that way. Others have talked about the difference in training between psychologists and psychiatrists and the contribution that that has to the safety of patient care. And I will make the point about that the medical training of physicians and of nurses provides a deep background of knowledge in anatomy, physiology, biochemistry, and other subjects that form the basis for their subsequent training in the pharmacologic treatment of mental health conditions. That is supplemented by clinical and apprenticeship training that is very long-lasting and I think is fundamental and extraordinarily important to the delivery of safe and effective care. I make the point in my written testimony that in Oregon, electricians are required to complete a 4 to 5 year apprenticeship, some 8,000 hours, in addition to the classroom work that they do before they're entrusted with the safety of others. Treatment of these psychiatric conditions, pharmacological treatment and medicine in general, is much more complex than that and potentially dangerous and deserves even more respect. I do not think that the training provided in this legislation is enough. I think that you cannot take a shortcut to competency. The second point I'll make is that this legislation enables prescribing psychologists to dispense medications. As you perhaps you don't know, in order for a physician to dispense medications, the physician must register with the Board of Medical Examiners in order to do so and keep very explicit records about it. Most physicians do not do this, and those that do in general do it in order to provide medications for patients who cannot otherwise afford them. When you do it, it eliminates an important safety check, that of the licensed pharmacist reviewing the prescription that the patient has, calls to physicians' offices to check on dose, strength, frequency of treatment, and so on, are very common and appropriate because that ensures the safety of patients. I think it's unwise to allow folks who are have a lower level of training in prescribing medications to dispense. The third and final point that I will make is about the supervision of the prescribing psychologists proposed in this bill. In this bill, the Oregon Board of Professional Psychology is charged solely with supervision in this area, and that board has no experience in developing a formulary or regulating pharmacological practice. The Oregon Board of Medical Examiners, of course, with its charge for the protection of the health, safety, and well-being of Oregonians, has very broad powers and very systematic methods to determine the competency and appropriateness of specialty practice. Its investigative, subpoena, and disciplinary powers are absolute, and they're frequently used to protect the public from any physician who is incompetent, unethical, or impaired. It has a diversion program for dealing with those who are substance dependent and for returning them to practice if that's appropriate. The Oregon State Board of Nursing has similar charge and powers. The Oregon Board of Psychology has no experience in this kind of area, and I believe that the task with which it is charged in this bill is beyond its current competence. As you know, the profession of psychology is divided regarding the wisdom of including pharmacologic treatment within its scope of practice. I'm not ambivalent about it. I think it's a bad idea, and I don't think it would solve the problems for which it is a proposed solution, and I fear that it would endanger the public. There are routes for psychologists who want to prescribe to take, and I think that if they take those, they will then be able to do the job safely, effectively, and efficiently. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Keepers. I appreciate the summary of your notes. Thank you. Next.
Madam Chairman, committee people, my name is Dr. David Conant Norvell. I come to you as president of the Oregon Council for Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. I'm a child psychiatrist, child and adolescent in general psychiatrist. I practice in Pendleton, Oregon. There are many things that I wanted to say, and it's all in my written testimony, so I will try to summarize a few items that are not redundant. First of all, I was the first child psychiatrist in Eastern Oregon. I practiced there for 6 years. I still go back. I travel there all the time. I'll be there on Thursday. That's why I can't be here on Thursday. When I'm not there, I'm on televideo to the residential treatment program there frequently. We've developed a good team. We have 3 child psychiatrists, and we travel to Pendleton, and we televideo. And our program has been awarded a lot of kudos from this legislature several times because of the quality of care, because it's a medically directed treatment program, and we've worked on that. In rural areas, there is a problem of care, but the big problem is quality of care. Now, one of the ways that we intend to address this is an initiative that we are starting at the Oregon Council of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry with the Oregon Pediatric Society. Starting this year, we're initiating a 3-year initiative to collaborate between pediatricians and child psychiatrists in improving the quality of mental health care for children in our community. And as child psychiatrists, we're committed to helping to be available to pediatricians, a problem, quite frankly, that pediatricians have noted, and to educate them on their role and our role, so that as child psychiatrists, we take on the very difficult cases and they take on the more primary care cases. We'll also be supporting family practitioners and nurse practitioners in this endeavor. I also would like to say that I work with psychologists all the time. I think one of the things that we have done in Beaverton is we've tried to develop a clinic that is a multidisciplinary, in which our clinicians use the strengths that they've been trained for, and we work together. So we have not only child psychiatrists, but we have psychiatric mental health nurse practitioners, we have consulting psychologists, we have nurses, we have a licensed clinical counselor, or licensed professional counselor, in addition to the office staff. And we work in ways where somebody has a certain level of expertise, and we use that expertise. And I would tell you that I think that licensed clinical psychologists are very well trained, in most cases, in psychometric assessment, which psychologists or psychiatrists are usually not as well trained in. They're also often well trained in certain aspects of psychotherapy. But psychiatrists are equally trained in that. But it is time that these pursuits that psychologists do are time intensive. And so they make a good member of the team. And so I would encourage them to be a member of the medical team, despite their lack of medical training. But I do not think that, and the Oregon Council of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry does not think that this bill will provide adequate training. And again, I would second, third, and fourth the comments that you've heard, that there are avenues for safe and adequate medical training that I would encourage them to pursue. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. And there's a lot of good information in your testimony, so I appreciate that. Thank you. Dr. Glockman.
Yes, thanks. Thank you, Chairwoman Kotick and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to testify before you. My name is Bob Glockman. I'm a practicing general internist, a primary care physician. I'm also the governor of the Oregon chapter of the American College of Physicians. And I'm the chief medical officer for the teaching clinics for Providence Health System in Portland, and as such have responsibility for the clinical operations of the teaching clinics for the internal medicine and family medicine residencies. I'm testifying in opposition to Bill 2800 for 2 main reasons. The first is significant concern about the training deficiencies that are outlined in the bill, as you've heard already. So much of medical training is not only just coursework, but it's in the experiential learning. And 1 year is simply insufficient for training practitioners to care for complex patients. For straightforward patients, that's not where the need and that's where not where the help is needed. It's for the complex patients. Some of the stories that you've heard today are in patients who are particularly complex. To think that 1 year of a practical training would provide people with the clinical training and experience necessary to care for the most complex patients is simply naive. With respect to the other factors, is the question that I have to ask myself is, does this lead to a collaborative care model, or does independent practicing actually lead to greater fragmentation? Because the goal that we need to have, and the evidence shows, that collaboration between mental health providers and physicians is what improves outcome the most. Because as Dr. Conan Norwell said, different people bring different skills, and it does take a multidisciplinary team. The problem with the mental health delivery system in this state is inadequate funding and a collapse of the infrastructure. And independent prescribing doesn't solve that collapse. We need a different approach. I don't believe that independent prescribing will sufficiently lead to improved health of the patients with mental health. What we need is more funding for the infrastructure for patients who have on Medicaid or where they're serious underfunding. So I would urge you to focus on the aspects of legislation that would improve collaboration. I'm aware of this comment about collaboration with the primary care physician that's in the bill. It's not really detailed as to what exactly that looks like. And independent prescribing isn't necessary for a collaborative care model.
Thank you. Questions for the panel? Representative Greenlee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Dr. Keepers. I'd like to ask you a question. We both worked in this field on and off. Can you imagine an education program run out of OHSU, out of your department? We've trained clinical psychologists already. That would be, a master's degree and an internship program, a residency program that could qualify psychologists to be prescribers?
Yeah. Representative Greenlee, thanks for the question. I'm puzzled about that quite a bit because there are psychologists who desire to acquire the ability to prescribe medications. There are certainly routes to do that. They can become psychiatric mental health nurse practitioners. They can choose to go back to medical school and continue through that route. These are relatively long routes, although I think the psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner is a practical route for many of them. I've also puzzled about the idea of an accelerated track through psychiatric residency for psychologists. That's something that would require national action. That isn't something that the state of Oregon could implement. But the training of psychologists sufficiently parallels that of psychiatrists in certain areas that I could conceive of a 2-year residency in psychiatry that would then suit them for psychiatric practice because they're training psychotherapy and psychiatric diagnosis and so on. I think the real difficulty with that is the medical school training that's required, and it's difficult to shorten that and have it still be effective. So that's the one problem with that line of thinking. I think there are ways to shorten it. I don't think there are ways to shorten it as much as some would like.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think, welcome, doctors. I think you heard Robin Henderson from Ben talk about how 15 to 20% of the psychotropic medication is prescribed by psychiatrists, and the other 80 to 85% is prescribed by family doctors. And I think the logic is that she was bringing was, therefore, for the family doctors who aren't comfortable, they need to go to somebody else. And in her opinion, that's one of these psychologists as licensed under this bill. But I'm trying to figure out why those family doctors who aren't comfortable can't go to a psychiatrist for that backup. I mean, other than we understand that there's a shortage of psychiatrists, but given the telemedicine and everything, is somebody going to say, well, sorry, I'm too busy, and go somewhere else, or are the family doctors going to get the backup they need from psychiatrists?
Well, can I address that? In our practice, what we've done is preferentially made our practice available as a referral service to pediatricians and family practitioners in Washington County. And so we've developed a large core of clinicians, and we basically, you know, you're our preferred folks. We take phone calls all the time. From pediatricians and from family practitioners, and that we see that as our job. And I, quite frankly, as the president of OCAP, I see that as our job as child psychiatrists. And it's not any different than other medical specialties in other fields, you know, working with primary care physicians. And I know that they do that at OHSU as well.
If I could address that question as well, Representative. I think the answer to your question lies in practice models like the one that you've just heard about. There are various practice models that make psychiatrists available to primary care physicians. The one that you've just heard, there's also one where the psychiatrist is actually in the primary care clinic, and we use that one at OHSU both in our family practice program and our primary care internal medicine program and at the VA. So that's a very effective model. Sometimes these are limited by reimbursement issues, and that's not an infrequent problem, but that's an issue that can be solved. And as you've heard, there's a shortage of psychiatrists, so that you can't do this all the way. The other thing I'd say about it is that a practice model that is extensively used, and particularly in organizations like Kaiser, is referral to the psychiatrist for diagnosis, treatment, and stabilization, and re-referral back to the primary care doctor for continued prescription of stable medications. In my view, that model works very well, and I have that kind of relationship with many primary care doctors myself.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Flores.
Thank you, Doctor. And you just said referral back to the primary care physician for re-referral of the medication, and you're asking the primary care physician to make a determination as to the psychiatric stability of the
Representative Flores, actually I'm saying that we would, after the patient is stabilized and on stable doses of medicine, we would then refer back to the primary care physician who had made the initial referral for continuation of prescription of the medication as long as there was no change in status of the patient.
Follow-up. Mm-hmm. So then they're just monitoring the patient to see if there is no change in status, and once there is a perception or it's some sort of clinical diagnosis that there is a tendency for a change, the primary care would refer him back to the psychiatrist?
Yes, that's exactly right. And, you know, it might be little is needed as a phone call in order to get some advice about what to do, or it might mean a referral back for an office visit for reevaluation.
Thank you.
If I might add a little bit, that's the model I used in Pendleton when I lived there and worked there. It's the model I used at the Indian Health Service clinic that I worked at for 5 years and on the Umatilla Indian Reservation. It works well if you spend time and train the primary care physician. Now, one of the things that I, last night, I got an email from Dave Willis, who's a developmental pediatrician and president-elect of Oregon Pediatric Society, indicating, and he couldn't come today, but that they're strongly opposed to this bill as well. But together, what we plan to do is work in collaboration with the American Academy of Pediatrics to develop, and they are developing a toolkit on mental health treatment so that pediatricians will be more adept and more trained in understanding psychiatric illness and the appropriate primary care treatments.
Thank you very much for being here today. Really appreciate your testimony, and thank you for staying late. Ms. Higgins, do you want to be the last one? I know you can't come back.
I'll be actually very, very brief. Felisa Hagen, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Felisa Hagen, political director of SEIU Local 49, for the record. We are actually in support of this bill for a couple of reasons, and one is the sort of model of collaborative care that is suggested in the bill. We are very supportive of a medical team working in efforts to heal people. We believe it's the most efficient form of care. The other issue is the cost issue that very few people have actually addressed in this hearing today, around not cost of providing the care alone, but cost to patients. The reality is if you're referred from one doctor to another doctor to another doctor, and your copay is about $25 each time you visit a doctor, and you make $10 an hour, including the time that you've taken off to see those doctors, it's very expensive treatment for you out of pocket. It doesn't also include travel needs, especially for our hospitals where we represent workers on the coast who travel pretty far actually to get the care that they need, as well as child care and other needs that need to be factored into costs of seeing doctors. So we'd like to for the committee to take this bill under consideration, and I think that as far as the training goes, I feel like that can be worked out with both parties. I feel like they're open to suggestions on amendments around that. So if there are any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For being here. So I know that some committee members need to go, so I'm going to honor that and say if you need to run, go. We have two more people that can't come back on Thursday that I work with. Okay. So I will just do those last two. That would be Dr. Mansour and Liz Dennis.
Did she leave?
Did Liz leave? Ms. Dennis, would you like to testify?
Yeah.
Like I said, we will have more testimony on Thursday on this. Obviously, a very complex issue. Really appreciate everyone's time and testimony today. Ms. Dennis, do you want to go first?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representatives. I'll make this very brief. I'm a board-certified psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner.
Introduce yourself for the record.
Pardon?
Your name for the record. Thanks.
For the record, I'm Elizabeth Dennis, a psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner from Westland, Oregon.
Thank you.
And I'm proud to say that I'm part of the solution for the rural health care. I fly to Pendleton, Oregon to work. I'm an attending at the Oregon State Hospital. Part of my board certification involved studying for a nationally accredited exam. And in part of those studies, they recommended that I review all the position papers for the International Society for Psychiatric Nursing. I brought that paper along today because they have a stand that is against psychologists prescribing, and they even go on to say that it is unethical for any nurse to support that a psychiatrist would prescribe. I have passed out handouts for you to read this, but I will quote that it says, "To assist clinical psychologists to gain prescriptive authority would be in violation of our nursing professional standards." And the highlight of the article mainly is about that they are inadequately trained to provide the care that goes along with the prescriptive authority. And that's all I'll say right now.
Thank you. Appreciate
that.
Thanks for being brief. Dr. Mansour?
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is David Mansour, and I'm a third-year psychiatry resident at OHSU, having done my medical school training at Oregon Health Science University. I just wanted to talk briefly about what my training entails in order to become a licensed psychiatrist in the state of Oregon. Our training starts in our before medical school in our undergraduate years with a strong emphasis on the physical sciences. We go on to enter medical school where we continue to train in the physical sciences, and I want to stress the importance of the education we attain in learning human physiology and human pathophysiology. We learn we learn about the human body. We learn about negative effects on the human body, not only of medications, but also of different disease processes. I think what I want to stress is that psychiatric medications and psychiatric illness does not stand in and of itself. It exists within the context of the human body. There are often a number of comorbid medical illnesses, including diabetes, coronary artery disease, renal disease. The medications that we prescribe oftentimes affect and impact these systems negatively, and the training outlined by the psychologist would certainly not be adequate to be able to manage, detect, and treat these medical illnesses caused by the medications that they propose to want to prescribe. So I think it would be highly unsafe.
Thank you. I appreciate the perspective of someone who's working their way up the profession. Thank you. Questions?
Yes, please.
Representative Greenleck?
I wonder if you note the irony of the fact that when psychiatric nurse practitioners wanted prescribing privileges, the medical profession argued it would be unethical for them to work with nurse practitioners with independent private because nurse practitioners didn't have a proper education. I mean, it sounded so familiar to me. I wondered if you felt any irony in your testimony.
Chair Kotek, Representative Greenleck, I'd like to respond to that question. Yes, I do. I have been at a position because nursing has fought long and hard to gain prescriptive authority. But the medical model did come around because we are so closely related. We have worked long and hard to get that prescriptive authority, and we have proved ourselves. And when they took a closer look at our education and training, that's when they realized that we do have the proper training, and we have been doing it now for years, and it has worked wonderfully. And we are highly respected with the medical community and with the general public. I also want to say that, personally, I have 27 years of strong nursing background. I graduated from a program that accepted 7 nurses into the program. Only 2 of them, and me being one of them, completed that program because it was so stringent. The advanced pathophysiology weeded out 5 of them right off the bat. And I want to say that, I lost my train of thought here, except that I know what it is involved in prescribing medication, and I take it very seriously. And I would never take a job that I didn't work side by side with a physician or have telephone access where I could immediately access them, because after what I have seen, it's just the patients are so medically complicated that I really am opposed to psychologists prescribing. They don't have the medical background to do so.
Madam Chair and Representative, if I can add on that also, I think in nursing school, nurses learn, they're trained from a medical perspective. Psychology graduate school is a social science training program. There's no training on medical illness, medical physiology, and pathophysiology. So in a lot of ways, nursing school lends itself to the medical background that is so necessary to prescribing psychiatric medications.
I also want to add that I have 60 patients at the state hospital right now. I could say 30 of those patients are severely medically compromised. And I talk to my chief medical officer and the internal medicine doctor every day that I work out there.
Thank you. Thanks for the clarification. Representative Flores.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and very quickly. Ms. Dennis, on the position paper that you distributed to us, now I note that it's a position statement dated, is this what you had distributed?
Yes.
Dated November of 2001.
That's correct.
And just in the context of, with our modern technology and data mining and development of all in all kinds of areas, 6 years is a long, it's light years. Mm-hmm. So is the position remain the same of the International Society of Psychiatric Mental Health Nurses 6 years down the trail from
yes,
the position?
Yes, it has. If you access their website, this is their current position. It hasn't changed. That's why they haven't revised it. They could update it, but their position has not changed.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I think with that, I think that was the final question. So thank you for being here, and thank you for your testimony. And so I'll see some of you back on Thursday. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2800. And thank you, committee members, for sticking around. And we'll close the committee hearing and see you Thursday.